welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Today was the Day of Action, a national day of action to reclaim the promise of public education. And, you know, a promise, like a lot of long-term, a lot of promises we've made seem to be getting broken daily. Promises that we've made to workers over the years, no problem breaking. Promises we've made to injured workers, no problem breaking. Promises that we've made to our children, well, we seem to be breaking. Today was the day that we said, you know what, we've got to reclaim that promise. So we're going to talk about that. Also going to have Governor, gubernatorial candidate, and Allentown Mayor Ed Pulaski here on the program. As the gubernatorial race heats up, he is traveling across the country, or across the state here, talking about jobs, 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 which is something I think we should have a governor talking about, don't you? I know we got a guy who says he's the more jobs governor. Not quite so sure if he is. Also, the end of the year is coming, and that's going to mean, if nothing's done in Washington, the end of the extensions for unemployment insurance. For workers who are still unable to find a suitable employment. The question is being posed, how long is enough? And I've had a couple of people email me, I've had a number of people ask, well, how long is enough? How long should we be paying these people to do nothing? And it's an interesting question, but I think it's the wrong question. We'll talk about my view a little bit later and how I think we can deal with this situation without pointing fingers, without assigning blame, and without demeaning and destroying. Also, the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Partnership Agreement seems to be our Xmas present. And yes, yes, I know. It's Merry Christmas, Rick. Are you engaged in the war on Christmas? Well, personally, I see nothing merry about this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, and there's certainly nothing holy about it. So I will say Xmas. It's a, I don't even know if it's really a present. I think it's going to be more of a curse. But we're going to talk about that. Also, your thoughts. I'd be interested in your thoughts, questions, comments. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me during the program at rick@thericksmithshow.com. So I had really a very interesting Sunday. And it's one of those days where you go, I wonder if all the people who spend their days and nights thinking about how you can attack the public sector workers, if this is a day where they say, maybe I'm going to shut up today. And the answer is no, they never do. But as I was driving the byways and highways in Pennsylvania on Sunday afternoon, and the roads were really atrocious, a sheet of ice, you saw people, and I have this theory as someone who's driven a truck for years, I have this theory about bad weather or snow conditions and people driving. There really are two types of people. There are the people who don't realize it's snowing and are doing 100 miles an hour everywhere. And then there are the people who are scared to death, petrified that there's a snowflake falling from the sky and are doing like 20 miles an hour, if that. And somewhere in front of me, the two of them generally meet. And, of course, it's a longer day for me. As I drive a truck on the weekends, you know, because I miss driving, but not on days like Sunday. And I must have seen, I don't know, somewhere 15, 18 accidents of people sliding sideways, bumping into walls, bumping into each other, rolling down into the snowy median there. And, you know, you go, one, because I've never had this happen to me, so I don't understand it. I've never had a situation where I have, you know, hit a wall unintentionally. I've never gone that out of control that, you know, it was slid down an embankment or anything. So I don't understand it, and I think it's because I actually know the conditions are bad. Take precautions. I mean, we're in this ice situation, and there are cars that are tailgating, and you go, really? And there are some people that go flying by, and you know you're going to see them in a little bit as you move mosey on down the road. But something caught my eye, and the reason I had to talk about this when I came in today is I read an article on from ABC, ABC News put out an article about the big 50-car pileup on the turnpike. And, yeah, there was a major pileup. And it's one of these conditions where you've got people all bunched up, and you got people all in groups together, and when one idiot does something stupid, it's just bang, 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 bang. And, you know, you may think that, you know, I've got the two car lengths in front of me, and that's enough time. It isn't. Because, of course, everybody does the absolute wrong thing when they see something ahead, and they slam on the brakes. And violently. And I saw that yesterday. I saw it on Sunday with just amazing clarity. You could almost feel the person in the car tensing up and then slamming on the brakes. And the car just did, you know, 360s. Which was fun to watch. I think it would be fun, you know, when I was a kid, when in high school, first learning to drive, we used to go do donuts in the parking lots. Sad reality is, you know, I can't do donuts now to save my life because everything's a crummy front-wheel drive car. No donuts that way, unless you're going backwards, which is a little bit harder. But I guess you can do it. But, you know, as you see these cars, you know, sliding into stuff and bang, 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 you just go, you know, I feel sorry for the people who are going to have to come out and dig you out. I feel sorry for the people who are going to have to come out and risk their health, their safety, their lives to come out and clean up this mess. But I saw this article at ABC News, and there was one line in it that really just grabbed my attention. A woman who evidently is, you know, related somehow to one of the people who work at ABC News. So I guess that's the reason that she was interviewed, because she was there. The quote that they pulled out, and I wish they had all of the interview with this woman, because I'm sure it's a bunch of anti-public sector, just anti-worker kind of screeds. She said, "The truth of the matter is nobody's doing anything for us." Well, you're in the middle of a 50-car pileup. It's going to take a while to get to you, especially on the turnpike. And, oh, did you know that they've been cutting public sector workers, that they've been cutting budgets, and that we've got a governor who's proud of the fact that they have basically gutted state employment? Pennsylvania has one of the lowest rates per capita of public sector workers in the country. And you go, well, if you don't think anyone's doing anything for you now, wait till they're done completely gutting it and privatizing things. So I'm looking through this, and I'm just sitting here going, you know, I've been in these situations where you're sitting in traffic for hours and hours because, one, they're taking care of the people who are injured. That's where they go first. And sorry that you're inconvenienced. Sorry that you have to sit there. Maybe if people were better drivers. And I've always advocated for, we have one of the most simplest, one of the easiest, one of the most ridiculously easy driving tests in the world. Okay, explain this to me. I still remember taking my driver's test. And you drove around the block. And if you didn't hit anything, and if you came to a complete stop at the stop sign, and you were able to drive through the little cones, they gave you a driver's license. And all you had to score was, what, 70%, I think it was, 70, 75? Really? And there were people who failed that. And they eventually got licensed. So, you know, I've always advocated for, you know, every 4 years maybe you should be tested, especially as we get older and we lose our reflexes. But Rick, oh, can't do that. I passed my test 30 years ago, and I'm talking about myself. You know, it's pushing 30 years. Because maybe if we had a more, and this is just one of, I guess this is one of my pet peeves for the night. Maybe if we had a more strenuous licensing process, maybe we wouldn't have such bad drivers. I mean, I have been behind big pileups, and because I'm one who leaves enough room between me and the people well ahead of me, I didn't get into it, and I don't get into it. And maybe if we thought more like, especially in bad conditions, if you know it's horrible out, you know it's ice out, but I've got four-wheel drive. Yeah. With four-wheel drive, that just means if you're on ice, that four wheels are driving and slipping as well. But I'm curious, what do you think? I mean, should we be having a longer, more difficult driver's ed process so that, and maybe having to learn to drive in the snow? And maybe should we be talking about truck drivers? Because, you know, I was looking at pictures from all across the country where we've had Texas, huge storms. In Missouri, all across the Midwest, huge storms with these huge accidents. And you see, you know, 20, 30 trucks all mangled together. Should we be having more strenuous testing for that as well? I mean, I actually saw three trucks in a line tailgating each other. They're actually drafting off each other. I'm going, really? In this? And then, you know, as I was coming out of the place where I was delivering to, I was single axle with an empty trailer, which means I'm not getting up any hills easily on ice. So I'm spinning my way up at, you know, half a foot per hour. And this car decides I'm not waiting anymore and tries to blast right by me. Well, what's he do? A 360 right next to me, almost under the trailer. And I'm going, you know, this is, and maybe it's just because we're in such a hurry. Maybe it's our societal curse. I don't know. But I just had to get that off my chest. I know, I try not to complain too much, but this just drives me insane. And please, by all means, if you're not on the side of the accident where the accident happened and everyone stopped at a dead stop, you don't have to stop too. Drive by. You're not going to see the mangled bodies, and you really don't want to. I've seen it. It's ugly. Keep going. Don't cause another accident behind you. Just a thought. And just me venting. So thank you for listening to my venting. And please, better driving. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the jobs tour by Allentown Mayor Ed Pulaski. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show. You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We can survive on 735! 15 and a union! We can survive on 725!
Using one-day strikes and protests in over 100 U.S. cities coast to coast, fast food workers and their supporters demanded at least $15 an hour and the right to form unions without retaliation on Thursday. In Madison, Wisconsin, state lawmakers joined clergy, other fast food workers, and community supporters as they entered a Taco Bell to support two workers as they walked off their jobs.
Come on out! We got you back! Come on out! We got you back! Come on out! Yeah!
As she walked off her job, Quanta Smith said she was against striking at first, in part because she feared being fired.
I was really scared I was going to get fired, but hey, if it helps the cause, I asked my boss, told my boss, listen, you know, I'm going to do it, so, yeah.
I have little kids, so I guess it's something, you know, for me to earn more.
If anybody can help, listen to this, and help us.
Sean Lane joined Quanta in walking off his Taco Bell job in Madison.
We're walking out today. The protest is in regards to the low wages paid by multi-billion-dollar corporations. For them to say that they can't afford to pay us a little bit more is asinine and selfish.
Lane says employer retaliation for striking is possible, but illegal, and he urged fellow fast food workers to join the strike movement.
Don't be afraid. Fight for what you believe to be right. Fight for what you deserve. Fast food is hard work. The lowest economic denominator in this country works incredibly hard, and we deserve more. We're worth more.
In the frigid cold, as workers carried signs and chanted, Wisconsin State Representative Melissa Sargent said taxpayers are footing the bill for big corporations paying poverty fast food wages.
The cost of public assistance to these families of these workers in the fast food industry is over $7 billion a year. McDonald's alone is costing taxpayers $1.2 billion. Here in Wisconsin, the cost of the low-wage workers is $166 million.
Rabbi Rene Bauer, director of South Central Wisconsin's Interfaith Coalition for Worker Justice, says economic inequality with extreme wealth at the top and poverty wages for millions is immoral.
I'm personally involved because I think that the wealth disparity in this country is the great moral crisis of our time. CEOs are making near $14 million a year while workers are having to rely on public assistance and working at least one or two jobs is why I'm out here. This is one way we can change that. The economy's not going to grow with the wealth all in the top tier.
The workers united will never be defeated. The workers united will never be defeated.
From the Fight for 15 Fast Food Workers picket line in Madison, Wisconsin, Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christians, right-wing Republicans, straight white American man.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Promise kept. I don't remember him saying when he was running for governor, I'm going to fire a bunch of people. Don't remember it. But for those people who were stuck in the snowstorm on Sunday, and for the woman quoted in the article who said, nobody doing nothing for me. Well, I know who we can point to. The guy who promise kept. We cut the size of state government. We cut the people out on the roads who were dropping salt. We cut the first responders. We cut all of those people. Congratulations. Promise kept. This from the more jobs governor. You buying it? I don't. Which is why I think this next year is so important for the Commonwealth. I think next year is important for the country. And who's governor of this state, I think, is vitally important, which is why we've asked Allentown Mayor Ed Pawlowski to come on the program, talk to us. He's running for governor. His website, PawlowskiForPA.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Ed, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, anytime, Rick. How are you doing tonight?
I am good. I didn't get into an accident on Sunday. I don't know if you saw all the pileups, but it's...
I did.
And I look at this, and then I saw this article I was talking about in the last segment that, you know, where this woman said, nobody's doing nothing for us. I love the phraseology. And I blame Corbett. I blame the people who should be putting salt trucks on the road. I blame the budgets that gutted that stuff. To me, that's where you place the blame.
Yep, I would agree. I would agree.
So,
like
and,
you said, promises kept.
There you go. And right there is the blame. I understand, unlike our governor who calls himself the more jobs governor, I guess more than Wyoming, you are out on a big cross-state tour, a jobs tour.
Yes, we are. We've been traversing the state. In fact, we were down in western PA on Sunday during some of that snow, and there was a truck that actually turned over on 378. I think it was like 1,000 pennies or something.
Wow.
Shoot all over the roadway.
You see anybody out there picking them up?
I don't know.
Well, I guess you could run a campaign with that. So, you know, what are people telling you as you're out meeting folks? Because, you know, we see all this rhetoric. The media that I'm getting at is that, you know, the governor has claimed he's the more jobs governor and that they created 200,000 jobs in with the drilling. Which, you know, when you really look at it, not so much, not even close, not even near that. But, you know, that's the talking point.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the jobs that have been promised are really not transpiring, are they? I mean, we were told that, you know, the industry would create lots of jobs, and that's not happening. In fact, we're losing jobs tremendously in the state of Pennsylvania. We have companies like GE that are picking up, moving divisions out of the state, 1,000 jobs lost to the city of Erie. You know, Merck, the 500 jobs are being moved out of the state. So while other states around us are actually growing their economies and gaining jobs and bringing more jobs back to the state of Pennsylvania, we're losing jobs at a rapid rate. And when you think about it, you know, as you sort of alluded to it a little while ago, you know, we went from 7th to 49th in job growth in just 3 years. I mean, think about that.
And which 3 years were those?
The last 3 years, the 3 years that have been the tenure of this particular governor. And, you know, we are not just ahead of Wyoming, as you suggested, and it's not a distinction that I think we want as the sixth most populous state in the Commonwealth.
But Ed, we didn't raise taxes, and we're business friendly. Shouldn't, if you believe right wing ideology and the talking points, by having low taxes, by giving huge checks and free money, jobs should be pouring in. Isn't that what we're told? Tax breaks, all that, isn't that the thing?
Listen, tax breaks are important, but you also have to have an overall strategy, and that's not what we have here in the state of Pennsylvania. I mean, think about it. We are the gateway to the entire eastern seaboard of the United States and the Midwest. Every, you know, ounce of product flows through Pennsylvania one way or the other. And yet we are the state that's actually declining in jobs. When New York, New Jersey, you know, Delaware, Maryland, even Ohio is growing their economies, our economy is actually shrinking. And you have to ask yourself the question why. And part of it is because there's no strategy. There doesn't seem to be any overall, you know, direction coming from Harrisburg as far as job attraction. Having these incentives is one piece of the puzzle, okay? And when you look at the puzzle, right, you start when you're building a puzzle, you look at the picture right on the box, and that sort of gives you a clue about how to put the pieces together. We don't even have a picture at this point. I don't think we know as a state where we're going and where we're headed. As far as building our economy and creating jobs. And so if we don't know where we're headed, we're not going to get there.
Right.
And this particular administration doesn't seem to have any plan or strategy for job attraction, you know, to use those incentives to really bring new jobs and growth into the state, job retention. There doesn't seem to be any focus, as you know, on education. We've lost 20,000 jobs from teachers alone the last 3 years from the cuts that occurred, you know, in education. And we're not building an educated workforce to attract, you know, companies, you know, back, you know, into the state. So I think, you know, we're lacking on so many fronts when it comes to job creation and job development. Now, at Allentown, obviously, we did a little bit differently, as you know. We weren't waiting around for the state or the federal government to obviously come in and help us, you know, to rebuild our economy. We actually wrote legislation that got passed 3 times through the House and Senate, creating, you know, thousands of new jobs, over $1 billion new development. You know, we got 1,000 union construction workers on the job now as we speak, you know, building out these buildings, creating lots of economic synergy. All the major component parts are being made here in Pennsylvania. So 5,000 tons of steel for these structures. That's enough steel to go, you know, make a beam 75 miles long, all being made in Erie, Pennsylvania. Union jobs to work in 3 shifts just to make that steel. 36,000 tons of concrete going into these buildings. That's, you know, 360 football fields of concrete, all being made by Burke's Products in Reading. So it's having economic ripple effects beyond, you know, the city of Allentown. And that's the kind of innovation that we need to bring to the state of Pennsylvania to really start our economy, jumpstart our economy, you know, bring development back to our state, as well as bring manufacturing, you know, back to the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and make sure
to build our own infrastructure.
Yep, and make sure that what you're consuming, you're building locally. And like you said, you know, the cement, the steel, all within the state, it's good for those areas, it's good for the state. It makes sense. And, you know, I talk to people who, you know, they're location specialists for big companies who I've met over the years, and they say, you know, there are 5 things that they look for in locating a place for their business. You know, the first 3 obviously are location, 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 which, as you pointed out, we've got in spades. And then there's infrastructure and education. And I look at the infrastructure bill that was passed. You got something, all right. It's not nearly what your own Transportation Commission said you needed when the governor put forth his Transportation Commission report. And you went after and you hurt the workers. It made no sense. And then you look at the education component. You know, this governor has been just horrible on education.
Yeah, I know. It's been hard. You know, we took out $1 billion out of public education a few years back. They put $90 million back this year. They have the audacity to basically say they're increasing funding for public education. I don't know what math teacher that they had in high school, but according to my math, when you take $1 billion out of the system and you put $90 million back, you still have a $910 million shortfall, and that's having devastating effects, as you know. 20,000 teachers have lost their jobs. Early childhood education across the state is being decimated. 72% of our schools now have increased class sizes because of these cuts. And, you know, we're slowly but surely dismantling the public education system of the state of Pennsylvania. And it's going to have dramatic impact on our economy. I also head up the Pennsylvania Municipal League. So I'm the president of the Pennsylvania Municipal League. You know that we have 54 cities in the state of Pennsylvania. 20 of the 54 are now in Act 47, which is basically a receivership.
Wow.
20 more, okay, are in the state's early intervention program, which means they're going into Act 47. So 40 out of 54 cities in the state of Pennsylvania are in financial distress. On top of that, you have Reading, which is now the poorest city in America, surpassing Flint, Michigan, and Harrisburg, which is bordering on the brink of bankruptcy. Something's wrong with this picture. Right.
Well, I mean, if you listen to the right wingers, Ed, you listen to my right wing conservative friends, they say, well, it's those public workers, it's those pensions.
Yeah, well, that's crazy. That's absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was just at a rally not too long ago in Pottsville, you know, really pushing, unions because, you know, they were trying to, you know, they were one of the, I think was. Giggling, it was basically trying to say that we need a right to work today, and that's going to fix the problem. But you know what? That's not going to fix the problem. That's not what the problem is here in Pennsylvania. You know what our problem is? The problem is we don't have a strategy and we don't have a plan. It was interesting to me. Mack Truck was here in Allentown, and they had actually closed their plant, their manufacturing plant.
Yeah, they're in McCungie.
In McCungie, they closed that down. They moved everything down south to North Carolina, right? The words, right? Well, a few years later, they moved the whole thing back because they realized they didn't have an educated workforce. It was costing them more money to retool and retrain people, and they weren't getting product out on time. And so they moved the whole plant out of North Carolina back here into Pennsylvania, into McCungie, and started operations again. So it's not about just about, that they were right to work state, and that's why they're growing. In fact, if you look at all the other states around us, they're not right to work states. They're growing, and their economies are thriving because they have a plan, they have a strategy. They're pushing growth and development within their state, trying to attract new jobs, new businesses into their community. That's not what we're doing here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Ed Pawlowski, Allentown Mayor, also gubernatorial candidate. Website Pawlowski. Mayor.com. We've got a link at the Rick Smith.
Pawlowski for PA.com.
Oh, sorry. Pawlowski for PA. And Pawlowski for Governor is your Facebook page. We'll get links for those as well. I'm looking at this, and I've heard you say a couple of times we need this plan. So what's the first thing that you do as governor? And looking at all of the mess that's been created these last 3.5, where's the first place you start? I mean, there's a ton, but what's the first thing?
Well, I think an overall strategy has to have a number of components. First, it has to have a business retention component. You know, I mean, GE just decided to pull 1,000 jobs out of Erie, as we talked about a minute ago. You know, I was there up in Erie when that announcement happened. I was actually doing a stop up there. The next day I woke up, I walked down into the lobby of the hotel, I looked at the paper. The response from the state is, well, we're going to send some money for retraining. Well, retraining for what? You just lost 1,000 jobs out of the state of Pennsylvania. I think we need a strategy to aggressively look at how we retain these jobs in the state of Pennsylvania. If I was governor, I would have been on the phone to the chairman of GE, trying to figure out how we keep those jobs here in the state. Also trying to figure out how we get a more division of GE comes back to the state of Pennsylvania and bring more jobs and more growth. So retention, I think, is a key component. I think, expansion, being able to recruit and bring jobs back to the state. There's no reason why the state shouldn't be at the top of the list, not at the bottom. We have a great workforce. We have a great location. We have a great distribution network an infrastructure that's built here in the state. There is no reason why we shouldn't be at the top of the list as far as states that are growing their employment instead of at the bottom. I also think that expansion. Looking at some of these foreign companies that are coming into the United States. They're going to set up shops somewhere. I want them to be here in Pennsylvania. I want those jobs to be here in this state. And being able to aggressively go out there and recruit and bring businesses into the state, I think, is a key component of any strategy. And then I think, you know, education and workforce development is another key component. And it, you know, but all this is going to revolve around a governor that has a vision, that has a plan, that's using innovative, you know, ideas to really stimulate growth and build our economy. And like I said, that's what we did now. You know, when I came in, Rick, to that city, it was like every other Rust Belt city in the Northeast and Midwest. Our economy was failing. We weren't seeing growth. We weren't seeing development. You know, our finances were in shambles. We were really on the brink of bankruptcy. 8 years later, we went from multi-million-dollar deficits to now a multi-million-dollar surpluses. We solved our pension problem. We have a fully funded pension, the only one in the state of Pennsylvania. Our crime rate is down 6 straight years in a row. We have $1 billion of investment happening in our downtown, thousands of new jobs that are being created. And this year, when I presented my budget, was the 9th straight year in a row where we did not have a property tax increase, and now we're the fastest-growing city in the state of Pennsylvania.
See, just my
That's
luck.
That's a pretty good success story.
Just my luck. You know, just my luck. I moved out of Cleveland to move to Pennsylvania. The Indians go to the World Series, first time in my lifetime. I move out of Allentown, and the property taxes don't go. 8 years ago, I moved out of Allentown. Property taxes stopped going up. Jeez. It's the black cloud from which I live under.
It's a good story. It's a story of success. It's a story, you know, about, you know, working to solve problems, you know, and working really quite honestly across party lines to solve those problems.
Let me ask you about that because, you know, since you brought it up, I mean, I look at what's going on in Harrisburg, and there are some forces in our General Assembly that are just insane. I mean, these are people that you absolutely, positively cannot work with. They're just, they're scorched earth mentality. How do you work with that?
Well, I mean, I think you got to find common ground. You got to find the center, okay? And you got to, you saw it with the transportation bill. It was going nowhere, but Governor Rendell pulled some Democrats to work with the Republicans. And it was a coalition that was pulled together in the past. But you like the bill or not, okay? I think it's about the bill. But, you know, they were able to pull some folks together in the middle to actually get something done. Now, I don't know, you know, why they didn't do that years ago and work on issues. But I think there's folks that are still in Harrisburg that still, you know, want to see things happen for the state of Pennsylvania and for Pennsylvania. It is going to be a tough, difficult road for the next governor. But just because it's difficult doesn't mean it's impossible.
Right.
And I believe we can pull those coalitions together, folks, just like you did now. You know, I realized long ago, Rick, when as mayor, that there is no Democratic or Republican way to pave a street or fix the pothole or pick up garbage or police the community. There is only the right way and a wrong way to do that. And I think that type of pragmatic approach is what we need back in Harrisburg. And that's why I'm running, because I want to bring some common sense, you know, back into a place that doesn't seem to have common sense on the agenda. And I think we can do that. I don't think it's an impossible task. It's not going to be easy, but I truly believe that if we don't turn the course of our discussion here in the state of Pennsylvania around and start focusing on education, start focusing on job creation, start focusing on the future of the state, that we will, you know, the state will continue to decline and will be at the bottom of that list of states in the next 10 to 15 years, and it'll take decades upon decades for us to recover from that. So we have an opportunity, I think, this election to really turn that around, but it's going to take someone who actually knows how to be innovative, knows how to work government, and that's why I'm in this race. I'm the only mayor. I'm the only one that's actually run the government. You know, I'm the only one that's really worked, you know, on the ground, taking on these issues on a day-to-day basis. And I believe, you know, we did it for Allentown. I think we could do it for the state of Pennsylvania. In fact, I know we can.
Last question I've got for you. We've been hearing a lot about Obamacare. We've heard a lot about the failures of healthcare.gov. It's my view that had the states done, much like Kentucky did. I mean, I can't believe I'm using Kentucky as the example. But had we a governor that said, we're going to set up our exchange and we're going to make sure that people get in health care, that get the insurance they need, what do you do on the exchange front? Do you take the Medicaid expansion money?
Yes, of course you take the Medicaid expansion money. I mean, you're getting 90% of your costs paid for by the federal government. What this governor's doing is just a ruse. I mean, you know, you have hundreds of thousands. I think it last told was 600,000 to 700,000 Pennsylvanians who are going without proper health insurance because we're not taking that money. You know, the federal government pays for 100% for several years and it drops down, to the least amount is 90%. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I'll take the 90% and, you know, if it's gonna cover 700,000 to 800,000 Pennsylvanians, you know, with proper health care, because in the long run, it's going to save us money as a state. It's the same thing that I argue with education, right? I mean, you know, we take a very short-sighted approach in this state, you know, when it comes to education. You know, I read a Pew study just recently, and the study basically said that one out of every 100 adults in this country is now in prison. Think about that. One out of every 100 adults. So we have more people in prison in this country than any other country on the face of the planet, including China, which is obviously not the bastion of progressive government. We spend six times more in prisons than we do on public education. And here in Pennsylvania, that holds true. In 1990, we spent about $80 million on corrections. 2013, $1.75
billion. Wow.
We went from $80 million to $1.75 billion. Now, I'm not suggesting that we eliminate money for Department of Corrections. What I'm saying is our priorities are wrong in this state. You know, I would rather build schools than prisons any day of the week. Any day of the week.
Well, doesn't it go back to what the guy said? You're going to pay me now or pay me later?
Yeah. I mean, what's happening is we got kids, because we've underfunded these schools, they don't have enough teachers to teach them, right? So we got kids in poor communities that are going to underperforming schools. They just don't have enough resources to operate. Who are ending up with no job, and so the only thing they can turn to is gang drugs, and they end up in prison. Well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather spend $10,000 to $15,000 up front investing in early childhood education, giving that kid a good start, than spending $50,000 or $60,000, you know, housing that individual in a county or state prison at the end. That's craziness if you think about it. But we have to turn this, you know, this paradigm around, and that's what we. That's what I want to do in the state of Pennsylvania. If we don't, honestly, as a state, we're doomed. We're doomed. Uh-huh. We're never going to be able to recover, you know, and really have an economy that's growing and thriving and one that we could really be proud of as a state. And every other state around us is going to be continuing growing. So I think, you know, we need, just like with healthcare, we need to change this paradigm, start looking out, you know, at what is the long term that we want to accomplish, and really start making policy decisions that are positive for Pennsylvania and for Pennsylvanians going into the future.
All righty, well, I'm with you. Again, the website, PawlowskiForPA.com. We've got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Also, the Facebook page, Pawlowski for Governor. We've got links as well. Mr. Mayor, it was a pleasure talking with you. I look forward to having you back on again.
Well, thank you so much, and please, your listeners, go to PawlowskiForPA.com. You know, the only way we're going to win this race is through help and support of folks, and especially our friends in labor. I mean, we've shown that, you know, by supporting good policies that support labor, we can really make a difference. I want to continue to do that as governor, but I need people's help and support to do that. So go, if people go to PawlowskiForPA.com and help us out, we'd really appreciate it.
All righty. We got a link at TheRickSmithShow.com. Just click on Mayor Pawlowski's name. It was great talking with you. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Time to talk.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Timmy Geithner has landed. The Secretary of the Treasury in President Obama's first term resigned early this year, and we lost track of him for months. But in November, Geithner reappeared, having spun himself through Washington's revolving door, whoosh, 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 and flung himself all the way up to Wall Street, landing softly in the cushy quarters of Warburg Pincus, one of America's top 10 private equity empires. Yes, the guy who was responsible for rescuing and regulating Wall Street's too-big-to-fail multi-billion-dollar financial casinos is now president of one. Writing in the New Yorker magazine, Andrew Huszar says we need not be surprised that the former Treasury chief is cashing in on his insider knowledge and contacts. Huszar worked at the New York Federal Reserve Bank when Geithner became president of that powerful supervisor of Wall Street firms. He says that rather than promoting knowledgeable regulators from within the Fed, Geithner broke with tradition and prudence to put top bankers from J.P. Morgan Chase, American Express, Goldman Sachs, and other powerhouse firms in key regulatory positions. In other words, the new honcho built his own revolving door in the New York Fed, bringing in bankers to regulate themselves. Thus, when Obama promoted Geithner to head the Treasury Department, Huszar was again unsurprised that our nation's overseer of banksters quickly proved to be their comforter and protector. Geithner never publicly advocated for the truly forceful and clean revamp of Wall Street, writes Huszar, instead using his influence to convince Obama and other lawmakers to be more accommodating to the big banks. This is Jim Hightower saying, whether spinning from the inside out or from the outside in, Geithner's proof that the Washington Wall Street revolving door serves bankers, not the public interest. We need to weld it shut.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christian, right-wing Republican, straight white American.
Well, there's nothing wrong with playing that twice in a row. To me, look, if you sat in traffic on Sunday because there weren't enough plows on the road to get the salt down and there's a sheet of ice, if you know who to blame. There it is, Mr. Mission Accomplished, Mr. Promises Kept. But Rick, you know, he can't raise taxes. He signed the Grover Norquist Pledge. Yeah, I know. Breaking news. The USA Today sent me a breaking news headline. Important stuff. Got to read this. Click here. Open quickly. Breaking news. Stocks rose today. Stocks went up. The S&P 500 passed the old closing high and set a new record at the closing bell. So Wall Street, again, fat and happy. Numbers are back. Congratulations. Happy to see it. Yay, Wall Street. Main Street, screw you. We don't need you. We've got Wall Street. We've got the bull. And, yes, full of bull. Today, the Federal Reserve released a report. Net worth of households across the U.S. increased by $1.9 trillion in the third quarter of the year. That's a new high, hitting a total of $77.3 trillion in net worth held by households across the U.S. $77.3 trillion. It's not a huge, huge thing. The Wall Street Journal points out that Americans' net worth is still roughly 1.4% below its peak, which I guess was back in 2007. Now, you remember after the 2008 collapse, households lost about $17 trillion in wealth. We're now back to, you know, almost right there. And it only took us, what, you know, 5 years? Banks, they're back to record profits in a much shorter time than 5 years. You know, the people who caused this. And you go, but hey, we're back. All right. That's good. Things are good. Problem, and you know, I've said this a number of times before, that wealth that's coming back, that house, that overall big number, that, oh, everything's wonderful again. Concentrating, redistributed. There we go. Got to use a Tea Party word. Redistributed to the top 1%. And I know. Rick, there you go. Beating up on the poor rich guy again. Understand. The folks up there at the thinner air, the top 1%ers, first 2 years of the recovery, they took 121% of the income gains. You go, Rick, how is it possible that you know, just a couple of thousand people took all of this in? Well, because they control the big corporations and they control the banks. And understand that wages have fallen. Productivity gone through the roof, wages are falling. So as we're working harder, we're working longer, wages are falling. Actually, they've stagnated. Inflation's just eaten them away. And in a lot of instances, they're going backwards. And we're seeing people getting fired en masse. And then finding lower-paying jobs. But 121% of the new income went to the top 1%. 121%. And you go, how can they take more than 100%? Well, that's because they took some from you and me. Now, think about it. We've had massive productivity gains since the recession. And again, wages are falling. So what you have, you got the likes of Rand Paul, who I don't know if you saw Rand on Fake News Sunday, where he said, you know, I support unemployment benefits, you know, for the 26 weeks. But if you extend it beyond that, you do a disservice to these workers. You do a disservice to people by giving them unemployment. Because we all know, right? They're lazy. They don't want to work. They just want to sit there and collect that generous benefit. You know, 40% of what they used to make, if they're lucky. Now, we know the facts. We know that the longer people are unemployed, the harder it is to find jobs. We know that. We've had employers tell us that. And in fact, Rand Paul himself went under this weird little spiel about, you know, if an employer... Now, I don't know where he saw this from, but these are his words, that if an employer sees a worker who's been unemployed for 4 weeks and somebody who's been on unemployment for 99 weeks, you know, who would you hire? And he says every employer said that they would hire the person who's been out of work for 4 weeks. So he knows that long-term unemployment is more difficult. The longer you're on it, the harder it's going to get. With no plan on how to get folks back to work. Now, look, do I think 99 weeks is too long? Because that's the question being thrown out there. Is it too long? Should we be cutting it back? Should we be cutting those people to the curb and let them commit crimes and go to jail so we can profit off of them? No. His solution, a very right-wing solution, cut taxes and give it to entrepreneurs so they cannot hire the unemployed people. Get that? Understand it. Because he already understands that you're not going to get folks. Employers just aren't going to hire them. He knows that. But his solution is more of the same bad stuff that got us into this mess. He says, you know, they're talking stimulus, that if we give these huge tax cuts to these companies, which, understand, they're not paying huge amounts of tax anyway. That's a canard. But he says that, you know, we got the free market stimulus solution, which is ridiculous because we know it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. But it brings me to this idea that, you know, I guess first, the stimulus thing, because, you know, we keep hearing the Paulian ideas. We need you to cut taxes. That'll be a stimulus. The best line I've heard on that if you give me, a small businessman said, if you give me a tax cut, I'm going to Bermuda. I'm going to go on vacation. If you give me demand, I'm going to have to create jobs. I'm going to have to meet that demand. And very fundamentally, two very different ideas how you stimulate the economy. By throwing money into it, by saying, here, you rich guy, or you, here's a tax break. Please create a job. No. Or here's some demand. We need concrete for roads. We need steel for buildings. We need stuff. Entrepreneurs will meet it. This idea that this is somehow a stimulus is ridiculous. Now, I look at the 2011 study by Congress, the Joint Economic Committee. They found, and you can't make this up, they found that long-term unemployed, those folks who had been on for quite a long time, that unemployment actually provided the best bang for the buck in terms of stimulus. Yeah. In fact, it was the end of last year when Congress estimated that the proposal to, I think it was earlier this year, that the CBO said that the Democratic proposal to extend unemployment benefits would actually create an additional 200,000 jobs in 2014. Now, here at the end of this year, if the Republicans can block enough, if they can stall and delay and do nothing like we've been doing for the last year, 1.3 million people are going to lose their benefits at the end of this year. Next year, about halfway through the year, another 2 million are going to lose their benefits as well. And what does that mean? Well, I mean, it means almost 3.5 million people are going to lose money to put into the economy. And you say, well, that's good, then that'll teach them because they're lazy. Or like Corbett says, they're lazy or drug addicts. But we know that's not true. And there's this bizarre belief out there that, well, you know, if you're getting unemployment benefits, you're not desperate enough. If you're getting unemployment benefits, you're not going to be out there looking for a job, which I find interesting because there was a new multinational study just out conducted by a guy named John Ihorn. He's a sociologist at the University of Edinburgh. The piece was published back in October in the Social Indicators Research Journal. And it points out that even the most generous of unemployment benefits had no impact whatsoever on people's drive to go out and get a job. Nothing. Icarn reports that the unemployment varied between countries. Some had more generous benefits, some had less, some had really good benefits. Not the U.S. I mean, we really do not have that great of unemployment benefits. Most countries had much greater programs with substantial income because they want to keep their consumers. Now, he reported that the unemployed, they varied from country to country, and the economic conditions varied, and the demographics varied, and all these things varied, but that unemployment had nothing to do with people's drive to go out and get that job, that the studies were people were out there looking, much like they do here. Now, understand, when you've got four people looking for every one available job, and you've got employers who are saying, well, you know, we're not going to hire someone who's long-term unemployed, what do you think you end up with? And for me, understanding that, and we know that, it's been pointed out time and time again, we know it. So what's the answer? Instead of allowing 3.5 million people to go, well, there's the curb, brother, how about a jobs program? How about we say, we're going to pursue full employment. We're going to have a Federal Reserve that's going to pursue federal employment, full employment, and a federal government who's going to say, you know what? If we can't get those folks jobs in the private sector, we're going to get them in the public sector. We're going to make government the employer of last resort. There are a lot of things that need to be done, and we should be doing it. Now, there are no Republicans who are going to go for this. They believe in retribution and punishment. If you can't get a job in the private sector, then never mind you. And, of course, all public sector jobs are bad to them, especially the guys who are dropping salt and coming to rescue you when you're stranded. Because I believe that, and I've said this, and it hit like a lead balloon to some. I don't think there should have been any extensions beyond the 26 weeks. I don't, because we, like and Paul says, after you're unemployed a couple of weeks, nobody wants you. And once you hit that 26-week mark, it only gets worse. And I've talked to numerous people who have been in this unemployment spiral downward, who, you know, they just can't keep full-time employment. You know, jobs, you know, business went down, oh, you're the last hired, first fired. Which is why I've been saying, after 26 weeks, your option is starve, or we will find you a job. You will do something that needs to be done. And government will be the employer of last resort. This way, you have a job, because as anyone knows, it's easier to find a job when you have one. Now you've got something to put on the resume, you've got something to keep your skills sharp, and you've got something that, in my view, because look, having been unemployed a couple of times in my past, you fall into a bit of depression if after a couple of weeks you don't find a job. And I can't imagine how bad it is now. I mean, when I was unemployed the last time, there were still unemployment offices where you would go and, hey, what'd you hear? Is there anything that you've heard of? Oh, and you do some networking of people who are out there looking for jobs like you are. They've closed all of that off. There were organizing opportunities in there where well, that's the reason they closed them, isn't it? But I look at this and there's really no solutions coming out other than the same failed stuff, which is punishment, which is, oh, well, let's just be business friendly and give huge tax cuts to businesses. Or there's the other Republican idea that Obama almost signed on to. Let's just let them work for free. We'll pay them unemployment if they go work for somebody for free. So it's kind of like government as employer of last resort. But the only problem is now you're destroying the private sector. Because, well, what happens to the people who had those jobs before the free people came in? And you know there are going to be industries set up based on how can we manipulate that? So, you know, the question keeps coming back, how long is enough? And, you know, until you find someone a job. And to me, it should be, you know, government's the employer of last resort. It's pretty simple to me. And I know it would work because it has in the past. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about today's National Day of Action to Reclaim Public Education. Quick break, right back.
Corporations get billions of welfare, while millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Corporations get billions of welfare, while millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Millions in this country don't have a dime to spare. Multi-billions in this country get not a dime to spare.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Detroit's bankruptcy is in federal court as the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees fights to prevent bankruptcy from slashing modest city retiree pensions. AFSCME Associate General Counsel Michael Arts says the union has three main arguments to defend the average $19,000 annual pensions of city workers. AFSCME says the bankruptcy is invalid because it violates Michigan's constitution, that it violates the federal constitution by intruding on state and city rights to manage their own affairs, and that legally required good faith bargaining with creditors did not happen before the bankruptcy was filed. Arts says this would be the ideal outcome in AFSCME's challenge to Detroit's bankruptcy.
That the retirees' pensions be protected, and that going forward we work out an arrangement where there can be some sort of defined benefit plan going forward so workers can have retirement security, but we can find out a way to make sure that Detroit is a vital city going forward.
Arts says that the bankruptcy plan puts bankers ahead of workers as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's appointed Detroit City Manager Kevin Orr pushes to reorganize Detroit's finances. When GM and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy, it was managed by the Obama administration to save pensions. Arts says Governor Snyder could also put the modest pensions off limits in this bankruptcy, especially since the Michigan State Constitution bans diminishing public worker pensions.
This is a moral choice that Detroit has made and that Governor Snyder has made to honor banks and corporations over regular people and over retirees, and we don't think that's right. We're hopeful that the appellate courts recognize that because you have to have state authorization in order for cities to file for bankruptcy, that the courts recognize that state laws should matter, and especially state constitutions should matter, and when the people decide through their elected representatives that pensions should be protected, and that if there's going to be financial problems, that the banks should have to give back first, that the corporations should have to give back their tax breaks first before we start putting our elderly and our retirees out on the street.
AFGE and NTEU, the two largest federal worker unions, are calling on Congress not to once again target federal workers as budget negotiators try to reach a deal. Budget negotiators are attempting to force federal workers to contribute more to pensions with no increase in the annuities payout when the workers retire. The unions note that federal workers have already given up $114 billion toward federal deficit reduction. Locked out AFT nurses at L&M Hospital in Connecticut could meet with management Tuesday for talks to end the lockout of nearly 800 nurses and techs. L&M cut off health care and pay for the workers, and a defense fund for the nurses raised $20,000 in less than 24 hours.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We need to show our children what our forefathers did before us, which was sit in and stand up for their rights. We weren't always granted our rights. We didn't always have schools for our children, and they're trying to take us back to that, and we have to fight back, because if we don't do anything, it'll be much worse.
Stop by the way.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So all across the country today, people have taken to the streets. There are activities, actions, food drives, all kind of things going on to reclaim the promise of public education, which is, you know, something I've been calling for several years now. I've been saying this is the hill the working class of this country has to fight and die on, because this is that opportunity. You know, 100 years ago, our children were in the mines and in the looms. 100 years ago, they didn't really have the chance that they have, the opportunities that we have today. And in my view, it's because of public education. Well, here to talk to us about it is American Federation of Teacher Vice President Ted Kirsch. Ted, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So, you know, you look at this, and I'm glad to see that there was this day of action where people were out in the streets to reclaim this promise of that opportunity for our children, that opportunity for our future.
Well, I think it's really important, and just as you were just pointing out, and if we take a minute to stop and think, what a great country we live in today. And for the most part, how did we get to this place? How did so many of us whose grandparents, parents, or different generations get to be the successes that so many of us have achieved? It was through public education. And what we see happening today in this country is a movement to destroy public education. Not to say that there aren't things that have to be done, improvements to be made, but there's a concerted effort to take away what helped make this country a great place to live in.
Let me ask you this, Ted, you know, because I've been looking around lately. I see what's going on in Detroit. I talk about what's happening with workers' compensation and a whole bunch of other things that really make me wonder if we're capable of keeping promises of the past. And, you know, there's this promise of education, which I'm glad this is the way they phrased it. But, you know, there was the promise of, you know, injured workers that you'll be taken care of and we won't blame you. And there, you know, all of these promises that we've made to state workers that their pensions will be there, promises that we've made to workers that will keep them safe. All of these things seem to be at this junction in time, things that maybe we're not so keen on or interested in keeping.
Well, let me point out that when we talk about reclaiming the promise of public education, we're not talking about going back to the way things were. We're talking about everybody getting together with a common vision for our school. We want great neighborhood public schools, safe and welcoming, for parents and community to come into that are fully funded and have teachers who are well prepared and supported and smaller class, manageable class sizes. We're talking about a curriculum that focuses on teaching and learning, not testing. That's what's happening the last few years.
Oh, don't even get me started on the testing.
Okay, I'll just skip that for a minute and talk about what we need. We need art. We need music. We need the science. We need schools to be the center of our community and to make sure that our kids and families have all the services that they need to meet their social, emotional, and health needs. We got to put the public back in public education. And so when we talk about reclaiming public education, we're not talking about going back to the way things were, but the way things should be, what we should have. And that's what this day of action was trying to accomplish today all over the country in more than 60 cities. And that's what we're trying to get. And we've got to work together. It's not just the unions. It's not just the teachers. It's the community. It's everybody. It's faith-based organizations. We got to take this back and make sure that our kids have the same opportunities that so many of us had.
Yeah, I wouldn't. I hope you didn't think that I was suggesting that that we want to take education back to the putting my kids back in the mines or in the looms.
I didn't mean that at all.
There are people in my view. There are people who do want to take us back to that, to where if you're poor and you can't afford to go to the school, you're going to have to go to work. You got the Newt Gingriches of the world saying, well, we should put those kids in the school cleaning toilets so we don't have to hire janitors. There is a view in this country, I think, that would be okay with taking us back to where if your parents didn't have the money to send you to a school, that, you know, shame on you.
Yeah, but I think you're right, and that's why we have to take it back. And that view is not, I don't believe, in my opinion, the majority view. I think that people are starting to feel helpless and not knowing what to do. And so when we get everybody working together, we're going to know what to do, and we're going to make a movement to get things the way they should be.
So how do we get to that point? I mean, we've got a governor right now who has just been, the absolute worst possible choice to run this Commonwealth when it comes to education and a lot of other things, but especially education. No one's going to ever attach the moniker of the education governor to the guy who's sitting in the governor's mansion. Now, I mean, you look at this, and I mean, how much worse could it get?
Well, unless we make him one term Tom, it can get worse if he's able to produce his program.
Senate Bill 1085.
What he's done in this Commonwealth is that he's made cuts of untold billion dollars. What we need to have a formula. We need to have fair funding. And this is cut across the entire Commonwealth. It's every community, whether it's the urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. Everybody has felt the impact of his negative views on public education. And so, you know, when you say, what can we do? I think at the top of my list is we need to have a new governor. And I've met with the different candidates. I'm not advocating for a particular candidate at this point, but because they all understand, those that I've talked to, the importance of public education. And we have to make sure that after the primary comes along, that we get together and unite behind a candidate and make it successful. We cannot allow ourselves to be fractured and everybody's all over the place with all these different candidates with different ideas. If we're going to make a change, that change has to be that we unite behind one person.
Yeah, I mean, just a little bit ago we talked with Allentown Mayor Ed Pawlowski, and you know, his ideas on education, I'm fully in line with. We've got to fund it. We've got to get some of those 20,000 education professionals back in the classrooms and back in the schools, and we've got to reclaim that promise to our kids so that there's opportunity for them. And I mean, just the basic. I know where you're at in Philadelphia. Back in September, there was a sixth grade girl went to school, no nurse on the premises, had an asthma attack and died. And you go, you know, maybe the nurse would have saved her, maybe she wouldn't have, but there wasn't even a shot of it because there was no nurse there. I can't believe there's not a nurse in the school. I can't believe there aren't guidance counselors in every schools or librarians. But I guess that's the reality of our schools in this state.
And it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be that way. And it's interesting that the governor was holding the school district, the Philadelphia, hostage with about $45 million of federal funds, wasn't state funds, just to be released to the school district that they were entitled to. And 3 days after this young child had a tragic death, he released the money. It's just, there is a connection there. There's no question about it. And the schools still don't have full nursing services. They rotate nurses between schools, and so it depends. Make sure you get sick only on the day that your school nurse is there, because it's not going to be good. You don't know what's going to happen. And we have tremendous health problems our youngsters have, from, you know, diabetes, from the asthma, the allergies. I mean, it's unbelievable what children are facing, and the schools, and we're failing to give them what they really not just need, but what they deserve.
Do you think this has more to do with poverty and you know, the minority status among a good number of the poverty-ridden schools in Philadelphia? Because I went to my school and I asked the school where my kids go, do you have nurses in every school? And they're like, yeah, we've got nurses. Do you ever not have a nurse? Well, if we don't, we get one. And they're covered. And I can't imagine not having a nurse in my kid's school. I can't imagine there not being a librarian. So do you think it has something to do with the fact that maybe you've got folks who are economically challenged and are struggling and don't have the political clout that maybe, you know, my neighborhood does?
Well, I think part of it is we've got to put that political clout back together again to communities. Poverty is certainly there's a clear correlation between poverty and achievement. And in many of the areas where we have the greatest poverty, we have the lack of achievement. I mean, that's already documented. I mean, but how do you justify, how do you argue that these kids don't deserve to have the same services that someone who lives in a different zip code gets? Look at the difference between what local communities put in terms of their schools, the per pupil cost. And when you say, well, you don't have the money, we do have the money. There are other priorities. Instead of these tax cuts that we give businesses, instead of giving away our natural resources in parts of the state, there are ways of getting this fund without tax increases. Doesn't have to have a tax increase to support public schools. But there's no will on the part of the present administration of the state.
And maybe, and the profiteering going on in education right now.
The charter schools, it's a whole new industry. It's a cottage industry. It's a business. They're making money hand over fist. And no one can show that, for the most part, I know it's a generalization, that the charter schools are doing any better than public schools, but people are making money out of it.
And, you know, I look at this, and I understand there's a piece of legislation making its way through the Senate, Senate Bill 1085, where they're now, and there's a lot to this bill that I don't like, but the one of the biggest things I think that catches my attention is that they're changing the what they tell us charter schools were. Originally, they're, I guess, innovations, laboratories of innovation, so that we could try different things and maybe move those best practices into the public school. Now they're just giving away that whole idea, saying, well, that really isn't it. They're just now what they are, other institutions that they're going to profit from.
Right, and the original concept, as you just pointed out, with the innovation and trying new things, It hasn't gone forward. It hasn't happened. And for the most part, most charter schools are not doing any better, and in many cases worse, than the public schools. And you have political decisions being made where, here in Philadelphia, they're giving public schools, giving away to charter school operators. And the budget problem here in Philadelphia, to a great extent, not solely, but to a great extent, the amount of money being given to charter schools without any accountability at all.
It's nuts. So last question, I want to go back to the day of action. What did you guys do down there in Philadelphia, and what's going forward?
Well, what's happened in Philadelphia today, and by the way, I guess like most of the state, this was not the most pleasant day. It was cold, damp, rainy. We had a demonstration in front of Governor Corbett's office. In Philadelphia. In Pittsburgh, I believe it was a similar kind of an action that took place. Part of the day of action is also a mobilization. This action today was not just the teachers' union. This was a community activity where parents, community members, members of faith-based organizations, it's a coming together to put together a program and a voice to improve public education. And so today was a national day of action. This is just the beginning. There will be more actions taking, more mobilizations taking, until ultimately we can create a fair, funded, highly successful public school system in this state.
That's what I want to hear. Ted Kirscher, I appreciate the time. I look forward to having you back on again as this continues, and I hope to hear more good news about this and also reclaiming our public education system. Ted, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, take your phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
This is why we fight, why we
for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Timmy Geithner has landed. The Secretary of the Treasury in President Obama's first term resigned early this year, and we lost track of him for months. But in November, Geithner reappeared, having spun himself through Washington's revolving door, whoosh, 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 and flung himself all the way up to Wall Street, landing softly in the cushy quarters of Warburg Pincus, one of America's top 10 private equity empires. Yes, the guy who was responsible for rescuing and regulating Wall Street's too-big-to-fail multi-billion-dollar financial casinos is now president of one. Writing in the New Yorker magazine, Andrew Huszar says we need not be surprised that the former Treasury chief is cashing in on his insider knowledge and contacts. Huszar worked at the New York Federal Reserve Bank when Geithner became president of that powerful supervisor of Wall Street firms. He says that rather than promoting knowledgeable regulators from within the Fed, Geithner broke with tradition and prudence to put top bankers from J.P. Morgan Chase, American Express, Goldman Sachs, and other powerhouse firms in key regulatory positions. In other words, the new honcho built his own revolving door in the New York Fed, bringing in bankers to regulate themselves. Thus, when Obama promoted Geithner to head the Treasury Department, Huszar was again unsurprised that our nation's overseer of banksters quickly proved to be their comforter and protector. Geithner never publicly advocated for the truly forceful and clean revamp of Wall Street, writes Huszar, instead using his influence to convince Obama and other lawmakers to be more accommodating to the big banks. This is Jim Hightower saying, whether spinning from the inside out or from the outside in, Geithner's proof that the Washington Wall Street revolving door serves bankers, not the public interest. We need to weld it shut. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls came down. They all in one. But the walls came down. I don't think there are any Russians. There ain't no Yanks. Just corporate criminals. What is it?
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our quote of the day from Richard Kirsch of the Roosevelt Institute. He said, Americans have a very strong sense that the deck is stacked against them by powerful corporations and the super rich who use their lobbyists and campaign contributions to control our government. Kirsch says, if Obama is going to rally people to take on those forces, he has to name them and take them on. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I think people in the streets, that's what's got to happen, and that's what's going to push things in that direction. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. Got Tom on line one. How you doing tonight, Tom?
I'm doing just fine, Rick. Good to talk to you.
Appreciate the time. What's on your mind?
I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what Ed was talking about, and then what Ed Hightower was talking about, and then I think Ted from Philadelphia. But let me go back to Ed. I think he was the mayor of Allentown. Is that correct?
Yeah, Ed Pulowski, right.
Okay. What we got going on is we have people like Ed who are trying to reach out to CEOs, reach out to big corporations to retain jobs, to expand jobs. And that's exactly what needs to happen in Pennsylvania. We actually need more of that. And I think you would agree with that, right?
It depends on what you were talking about to retain them.
Well, we're talking about retaining jobs. We're talking about keeping the manufacturing here. We're talking about keeping the income producers in Pennsylvania. Agreed?
Yeah, I'm all in favor of retaining the jobs, but you know there are some times where you go, what are we giving up for it? I go back to my time growing up in Cleveland, where we had a mayor who became, you know, senator and governor, George Voinovich, who basically gave away the entire tax base, 25-year tax abatements, free water, free sewer, free energy, free everything to bring these companies there who eventually left. It didn't really do the community any good because when they moved in, they brought workers with them. So, you know, I'm in favor of retaining jobs, but not at any cost.
But you are constantly bashing the CEOs and the big corporations.
I am.
Ed, on the Democratic side, and I'm not a Democrat, but Ed has the right idea. The idea is for government officials to connect with large corporations to try to retain those jobs in Pennsylvania. There is a competitive market out there. The different states are trying to bring those jobs here or to their state.
Well, let me ask you this, Tom.
Pennsylvania has got to remain competitive in that.
Okay, well, let me ask you this.
And what I have an issue with you then is Ed is trying to bring those jobs here at the very same time that you are bashing those corporations. And you're probably fully aware that it is the CEOs who are making money. It is the corporations that are making money who today are bringing work to Pennsylvania. They are the people creating the jobs. Unions don't create jobs. The low-scale workers don't create jobs. It's the CEOs and the large corporations.
So we should give them carte blanche then and say we're going to give our entire tax base away. Because what you're saying is, and I've qualified what I believe, and you say that I'm bashing the companies. Yes, I'm bashing companies who take jobs overseas, that pay zero income tax, that abuse their workers, that pay crummy wages and take huge subsidies. You're absolutely right, and I will continue to do that. There are companies that do pay their fair share in taxes, that do a good job for society, for the, for this country, and I give praise to them. But well, go back to what I said from the beginning, to qualify, not at any cost. So
I didn't say at any cost. All of these are business decisions that need to be made.
But if you've got states that are pitted against one another, if you've got states that are pitted against each other, the only way to go is down. Huge study after study has shown that these huge handouts to companies do not benefit anyone. But the big.
So what is your solution? Do you just want to have government create jobs? You talk about schools not being funded. I totally agree with you. The way to get education funding going again is to have ascending property values. You need to have properties being transferred so you get the windfall from the taxes. They come into municipalities. They come into the school districts. In Pennsylvania, we've lost that. And when you have descending property values, it's a vicious cycle. And we do need people like Ed who want to bring the jobs in. You can't have it both ways.
You can't have a system where you say we're not going to, and I firmly believe this is something that has to be done by the federal government, that we have to stop this beggar. Now you've spoken, let me speak.
Go ahead.
What has to happen is the federal government has to stop this beggar thy neighbor economic development. We have got to stop giving away tax dollars to these huge employers because they can hold us hostage. In right on the Missouri Kansas border right now, the governor of Missouri is begging the governor of Kansas to stop this handing out huge checks to these companies that are moving across the city of Kansas City and gutting the city's funding levels. Every major city in this state, as Ed Pulaski pointed out, is starving because we're pitting ourselves against each other for these jobs. At some point, someone has got to say, stop handing out tax money to these companies and put it back into education. Your idea of property taxes ascending, okay, fine. How many people are now complaining property taxes are too high? So this idea of yours sounds great on paper. Let's just tax people with their property, but good luck on that. Not going to work.
Rick. Did I say anything at all in my conversation about government handouts? I did not say that.
But that's you're advocating. Well, hold on. Again, going back to what I said from the beginning is not at any cost. And what job attraction in this country has turned into is how much money can each state, each municipality, each local city hand to these companies. And what I said from the beginning is I'm not in favor of giving huge checks to these people. You look at where I live in Carlisle. A company 93 years was in the community. They moved to Tennessee because Tennessee gave them $40 million. The state was only going to, Pennsylvania was going to give them 15. They ran for the money. And when you have this kind of beggar thy neighbor economic development, it is a race to the bottom that destroys our tax base, it destroys our schools, destroys our infrastructure. So if you want to have an argument how we create jobs, that isn't the way. If you want to talk about building infrastructure, building education, having an educated workforce and a solid infrastructure, I'll talk with you all day long. But I'm not going to say, let's just give out huge checks. I'm not going there, Tom.
Rick, I never said that. You're assuming I'm saying that. What brings jobs into a community is good infrastructure. In most cases, it's good transportation. We are blessed with good transportation with I-81 through our area. We are also blessed with a good workforce and a good job work ethic in South Central Pennsylvania. We are also blessed with a pretty good educated workforce with our universities, with the local Penn State campuses, Mount Alto, Harrisburg, Shippensburg, some of the spinoffs in Harrisburg, with the community college. Now, I totally agree. We need more. But when these large businesses look to relocate. They look at all of that. And another thing they look at, though, very clearly, is the regulations. And they do look at these tax rebates. They look at the alertas. They look at these sort of things. And if they're not there, and it's really more of the overregulation that drives people to some of these other states.
Well,
and Rick, I'm a consultant who works with international companies and national companies and facilitate their relocation into South Central Pennsylvania. I sit with those people in site searches. And I listen to what they're saying. And they absolute resent.
Okay. So I got about 2 minutes.
Attitude that bashes them.
I got about 2 minutes here, and I want to clear this up. So what you're telling me, I just want to make sure I'm getting clear what you're saying. In order for these companies that you sit down with, we need to gut our regulations, we need to gut our conditions here so that we can attract them.
Rick,
so
forget the word gut. Don't take everything to an extreme.
I'm taking you what you're telling me, because what you're saying is we're competing with other states. We're competing with South Carolina.
Yes.
We're competing with other states.
We're competing with other states.
And in order to compete with them on a certain level, we have to gut our regulations and take them down to their level. Basically, the same mentality as our trade agreements with Mexico. The least restrictive trade or the least restrictive regulation. Is that where you're telling me we're going?
I didn't say that we need to go there. I also resent all the government handouts. But you've got to recognize that is a fact of life.
I do recognize.
That happens on the state level, and that happens on the federal level. The federal government does exactly the same thing with infrastructure dollars. It's going on, and if you're not willing to face that fact, and if you're not willing to start to raise the income of people in our area, because it is an ascending income.
Yeah,
it's not about the minimum wage. It's about it slowly, systematically increase the amount of money in people's checkbooks.
Yeah, that's a longer conversation that I've got here. I've got to take a quick break. I do appreciate the call. Please call back at some point again. I would love to pick this up again. I've got a guest here at this next, after the break. Tom, I appreciate it, though. Thanks so much.
Okay, hey, thanks.
Yeah, we'll talk about this again, I'm sure. Let's take a quick break right back. Stick around here. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Detroit's bankruptcy is in federal court as the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees fights to prevent the bankruptcy from slashing modest city retiree pensions. AFSCME Associate General Counsel Michael Arts says the union has three main arguments to defend the average $19,000 annual pensions of city workers. AFSCME says the bankruptcy is invalid because it violates Michigan's Constitution, that it violates the federal Constitution by intruding on state and city rights to manage their own affairs, and that legally required good faith bargaining with creditors did not happen before the bankruptcy was filed. Arts says this would be the ideal outcome in AFSCME's challenge to Detroit's bankruptcy.
That the retirees' pensions be protected, and that going forward we work out an arrangement where there can be some sort of defined benefit plan going forward so workers can have retirement security, but we can find out a way to make sure that Detroit is a vital city going forward.
Arts says that the bankruptcy plan puts bankers ahead of workers, as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's appointed
appointed Detroit City Manager Kevin Orr pushes to reorganize Detroit's finances. When GM and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy, it was managed by the Obama administration to save pensions. Arts says Governor Snyder could also put the modest pensions off limits in this bankruptcy, especially since the Michigan State Constitution bans diminishing public worker pensions.
This is a moral choice that Detroit has made and that Governor Snyder has made to honor banks and corporations over regular people and over retirees, and we don't think that's right. We're hopeful that the appellate courts recognize that because you have to have state authorization in order for cities to file for bankruptcy, that the courts recognize that state laws should matter, and especially state constitutions should matter, and when the people decide through their elected representatives that pensions should be protected, and that if there's going to be financial problems, that the banks should have to give back first, that the corporations should have to give back their tax breaks first before we start putting our elderly and our retirees out on the street.
AFGE and NTEU, the two largest federal worker unions, are calling on Congress not to once again target federal workers as budget negotiators try to reach a deal. Budget negotiators are attempting to force federal workers to contribute more to pensions with no increase in the annuities payout when the workers retire. The unions note that federal workers have already given up $114 billion toward federal deficit reduction. Locked out AFT nurses at L&M Hospital in Connecticut could meet with management Tuesday for talks to end the lockout of nearly 800 nurses and techs. L&M cut off health care and pay for the workers, and a defense fund for the nurses raised $20,000 in less than 24 hours.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're not going to let people do school reform in the name of school reform in a way that makes the schools bad. Us educators have a real stake in that.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I got the conversation with Tom banging around in my head. You know, this idea that, and it's one of those things that I appall. You know, having grown up in Cleveland, I saw the tax base eviscerated because we were giving these huge handouts to these companies, 25-year tax abatements, all the free power and water and sewer and all of that stuff. And what it did to the school system in Cleveland just eviscerated it. Crumbling schools, crumbling infrastructure, because, you know, we had to compete. We had to attract those jobs at any cost. And that's my problem. It's just at any cost. So we end up giving all this money away and our schools suffer. And that's why I think today across the country you're seeing actions in reclaiming our public education, which is why I've got Susan Solomon. She's executive vice president of United Educators of San Francisco, here to talk about the situation out there. Susan, thanks for taking time for us.
Certainly. Thank you, Rick.
You know, I look at this situation, and it's just not where I grew up in Cleveland. It's virtually every major city and every city in the country where we've got to attract these businesses, and you've got this mindset. We've got to attract business. So we give out all our tax base. And here's the baby, here's the bathwater, even take the tub. And what we end up with are school districts that are starving and neighborhoods that are struggling. And, you know, I look at what's going on in your neck of the woods, same thing.
It is. It's the same thing. We have corporations moving in, Twitter being the biggest, that to encourage Twitter to move into San Francisco, the mayor offered them a payroll tax break to the tune of $52 million. We have at least 11 or more businesses probably by now who find ways to appeal their property tax amount, and those just sit there. And what's particularly painful about property tax underpayment is that 10% of what's collected goes directly to the school district fund. So we see, huge businesses moving in, rents going up tremendously, so that the families, our students' families, and our own teachers and paraprofessionals and counselors cannot afford to stay in San Francisco.
Yeah, but Susan, I've just been told that that's a good thing. That's going to be good for the economy. Property values are going to go up and pay higher taxes. We can fund the schools with that.
if only they paid their taxes, maybe that would be true. I'm not sure who they would end up serving when the current median rent for an apartment in San Francisco is now $3,398 a month.
What?
It's up 21% just in the last year. And so we have people who are fully employed, including teachers, who cannot afford to stay in San Francisco. So at what expense are we getting these businesses in San Francisco?
Now, I understand in looking at some information that $100 million in tax money has been lost through this free tax zone that they've got out that way?
It's probably that amount by now, because Twitter was the one who started, but others are now moving in into that, what we call the mid-market street corridor, and getting similar tax breaks. We know that the Westfield Mall, which they are all over the country. We have one in San Francisco, and in the state of California alone, they have underpaid in their taxes $40 million in a year. And that means that kind of money could mean an additional over 500 teachers in kindergarten to 12th grade, 340 nurses, 420 guidance counselors. And the numbers are just staggering.
And the sad reality is, as you look at that short-term investment that you make in the youth of this country, what does it mean long-term when they don't get it? And that's one of the things that gets me. I mean, you know, it's nice to say tip of the nose, we saved a couple of bucks today, but what's that going to mean for us a generation from now, two generations from now?
That's exactly our concern. I mean, the lip service that's given to this is that we're moving businesses into San Francisco. So we create a job market, and people in San Francisco will get those jobs. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, many families are leaving San Francisco now. But in addition to that, I'm not convinced that they are creating the jobs that our students are being trained for, merely because there's not enough money for the kind of education that is needed to fund to get our young people prepared for those jobs. Not that those are the only jobs. There are lots of valuable jobs out there. But if you shortchange public education, you're really shortchanging the public.
And I look at this, and it comes back down to this mantra that's out there that we need to cut taxes on businesses. We need to cut taxes on the very wealthy, because they're the job creators, after all. Don't you know, Susan? They give us jobs because they're benevolent. Not because they need us to do their work, but because they're benevolent, they're just good people. And you shouldn't say bad things about them when they move jobs to China or India or pay 0% income tax. You shouldn't say anything bad because they're good, benevolent folk.
Well, though, they could prove that by making sure that people have jobs. In terms of the city of San Francisco, so many of the jobs, we've seen it in every major city. We used to have thriving jobs here for not just, we have a fairly lively port, not as lively as it used to be, but we used to have manufacturing jobs. We had a coffee plant. We had other food plants. We had real manufacturing here. Those jobs are virtually gone.
But you know, Susan, we caused those jobs to leave because of our overregulation, didn't you hear?
We're just strangling
them because we're not willing to sacrifice our workforce or our health or the environment. We're strangling them.
I can really see how they're hurting. When we see record-breaking profits, we have, just like everywhere else in the country, we have Walmart workers. We had a young man who spoke at our rally today who was going to community college and working at Walmart, and he got fired. Mainly because he spoke up for himself, wanted to change his hours so he go to school. He was making $11,000 a year.
Wow.
I am pretty sure that if Walmart tripled his salary, they still wouldn't see much harm to their profit. It really is. It's about profit. And, there are so many other things that have changed about San Francisco. I grew up here. I've lived here nearly my whole life. And I can see we've seen a vast change in the diversity of the city. So when I was growing up, somewhere nearly 20% of the population was African American. We're down to about 4% now. We now have more dogs in the city than we have children.
Wow.
This does not speak to family values. And much of that has to do with the people who can afford to live here. Again, because corporations are not paying their fair share.
That sounds like gentrification on steroids.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe we could break out the Bush Mission Accomplished banner.
There we go. We have our own version of Mission Accomplished.
It doesn't sound good. I mean, it doesn't sound good. So you had folks out in the streets today, and good on you. I think there has to be more of these events. I think we need to wake up more people. Where do you go from this point? I mean, you had today this day of action. Where does this go from here?
Well, one of the wonderful things that happened around creating this day of action was a coalition that's coming together now. It's started in San Francisco a little over a year ago when we realized that, you know, we do have some thriving community organizations, parent organizations, our own union, and we were all fighting for the same thing. And we came together around what some people have called the achievement gap. Now, really, we see it as an opportunity gap, an economic gap, and we started talking about what is it that we need for students so that they can be successful. And we had meetings and town hall forums over the about a year and a half. And when we decided to participate in this National Day of Action, we were really able to reach out to so many organizations, and at least 20 organizations, housing organizations, tenant rights, senior disability rights groups, our own union, our community college union. So many different people came together, and it makes me more hopeful than I've been for a while that, you know, it's really true. Together we are stronger.
And, you know, at the end of this, it comes down to having that conversation. Do we want a Walmart model for the country? Is this low wage at any cost model, is that the right model for the nation? Is a public education affordable and an option for only those who can afford it? And the rest of us, is it back to the looms for my kids or back to the mines for my kids?
Right. I mean, sounds dire, but if we don't pay attention and keep doing what we're doing, we could go down that road. And, you know, I'm proud to say as a native San Franciscan that we don't have a Walmart in San Francisco. So far, we've been successful in keeping them out. And I'm convinced that if it weren't for community activists and labor activists, that would not be true. We were able to keep out fast food places in San Francisco well into the years that they were in other cities. It was actually a sad day when I was in high school and we got the first, whatever it was, McDonald's in San Francisco. So we do have a history of standing up for working people.
And I'm hoping that by you coming and telling your story, others in our listening areas across the state of Pennsylvania, they'll come do it as well, because I do believe that we can change our communities for the better. And if you change your little slice of the world, maybe somebody else will want to change theirs, and that's how we change the world.
That's it. I mean, it's really true. Don't think you can't do anything, because you get together with a few other people, and then that grows and that grows. And that's right. That's how. And we don't have another choice of how to change the world. We don't have the millions and billions of dollars that our detractors have.
And that message that our voice matters, I think, is really an important one to put out there. That you know, I know a lot of times I talk to people and say, you can't do anything. You know, you can't fight City Hall. You know, I'm just one guy. Yeah, just one guy standing next to another guy and next to another woman. That's how you build power.
That's how you build power. That's how we won anything we ever won that was for the dignity of working people happened that way. It's not because, you know, Andrew Carnegie or Sam Walton did something for us.
It's because we took
what we did for ourselves.
Absolutely. Susan, it was great talking with you. I appreciate the fact that you were out in the streets today. I appreciate the work that you do. I'd love to have you come back and talk to us in the future when this stuff comes up again.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Thank you so much. Susan Solomon, Executive Vice President of United Educators of San Francisco. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Public liberty, someday, somewhere.
exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Seems like things are kind of upside down. Children, you someone to turn around.
I miss Herman. I do. I really miss the 2012 presidential primary. I do. I just, you know, I that was mastery. It was pure comical genius. You couldn't have scripted that. You couldn't have scripted Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and that whole sideshow that all of the sideshows. Just amazing stuff. Today, a little bit of history. Here was 1921. Guy named Thomas Midgley. Thomas Midgley Jr., actually, a young engineer for General Motors, came up with the idea that, hey, what if we add lead to gasoline? That sounds like a good idea. Maybe it would stop that knocking and pinging noise that they found that when, you know, they built the compression engines, that, you know, that by burning gasoline, it burns so hot that it made it sound like the insides of the engine were falling apart. What they found was if they added lead, just added a little bit of lead to the gasoline, it stopped because it fiddled with the octane, which made it burn a little less hot. But they didn't quite figure out until, well, a couple, like 2 years, 3 years later, is that, well, you could get sick, lead poisoning. And in fact, February of 2013, when the first filling station sold the first gallon of leaded gasoline in Dayton, Ohio, Midgley, he didn't show up. Why? Why, you may ask? Well, why, Rick? Why did he show up? He was in bed with a severe case of lead poisoning. He did recover. Good for him. But it did end up killing a couple of his coworkers in April of 1924. And in October of 24, five workers at the Standard Oil lead plant died as well after what one reporter called retching fits of violent insanity. Almost 40 of the plant's workers suffered severe neurological symptoms like hallucinations and seizures. Understand, they put this in it just to stop the knocking and pinging. And I remember as a kid, acid rain. I remember some other, lead, no good for you. And here's the really sick part of this. And this is where it comes back to me on this business-friendly mentality. They knew almost immediately what the health risks were. They knew almost immediately that this stuff was dangerous. But the reason they kept putting it in is because it was cheaper. And the only other things that they could find were either really, really hard to manufacture and cost a little bit of money, or, and, no surprise, it was something you could probably make in your bathtub. It was something very simple. They said there were a couple of things. Iodine worked, but the process was really complicated. But ethyl alcohol was something that they were, that used. It was extremely cheap, but anyone could make it, which meant that GM couldn't patent and profit from it. So when people say, well, Rick, we need to be business friendly. So, oh, God awful regulations. Hey, thanks to the EPA, they stopped putting lead in gasoline. Oh, it's those onerous, god-awful regulations just stifling profit and business. 1921 until the 70s. 1921 to the 70s, 50 years, they knew this was poisoning people. But, got to be business-friendly because we don't want to stifle big business with pesky little things like kids with lower IQs and people violently hallucinating and seizures. Those are just minor little things. So when people say, wow, you don't like business. No, I like business just fine. Business to me is not the do-all, end-all. Business to me is a tool to get things done. They are not people. And if they want to be in our community and do business in our community, this is where this whole thing fundamentally is flipped on its head, where we are pandering to businesses. Oh, please, oh, worshiping. Instead of the other way around, they want access to our markets. They want access to our country, to our states, to our consumers, our workers. There are rules that we, the people, breathing, dying people, make. To me, it's that simple. And I know some will say, it's wrong, but we need to hand big checks and deregulate, lower taxes. I was just looking at something in the break, a New York Times article from July. The large corporations in this country paid 12% federal tax, not the 35% that they keep throwing at, 12%. And a large number of them paid zero. Quick break, right back with hour three. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Detroit's bankruptcy is in federal court as the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees fights to prevent the bankruptcy from slashing modest city retiree pensions. AFSCME Associate General Counsel Michael Arts says the union has three main arguments to defend the average $19,000 annual pensions of city workers. AFSCME says the bankruptcy is invalid because it violates Michigan's Constitution, that it violates the federal Constitution by intruding on state and city rights to manage their own affairs, and that legally required good faith bargaining with creditors did not happen before the bankruptcy was filed. Arts says this would be the ideal outcome in AFSCME's challenge to Detroit's bankruptcy.
That the retirees' pensions be protected, and that going forward we work out an arrangement where there can be some sort of defined benefit plan going forward so workers can have retirement security, but we can find out a way to make sure that Detroit is a vital city going forward.
Arts says that the bankruptcy plan puts bankers ahead of workers, as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's appointed Detroit City Manager Kevin Orr pushes to reorganize Detroit's finances. When GM and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy, it was managed by the Obama administration to save pensions. Arts says Governor Snyder could also put the modest pensions off limits in this bankruptcy, especially since the Michigan State Constitution bans diminishing public worker pensions.
This is a moral choice that Detroit has made and that Governor Snyder has made to honor banks and corporations over regular people and over retirees, and we don't think that's right. We're hopeful that the appellate courts recognize that because you have to have state authorization in order for cities to file for bankruptcy, that the courts recognize that state laws should matter, and especially state constitutions should matter, and when the people decide through their elected representatives that pensions should be protected, and that if there's going to be financial problems, that the banks should have to give back first, that the corporations should have to give back their tax breaks first before we start putting our elderly and our retirees out on the street.
AFGE and NTEU, the two largest federal worker unions, are calling on Congress not to once again target federal workers as budget negotiators try to reach a deal. Budget negotiators are attempting to force federal workers to contribute more to pensions with no increase in the annuities payout when the workers retire. The unions note that federal workers have already given up $114 billion toward federal deficit reduction. Locked out AFT nurses at L&M Hospital in Connecticut could meet with management Tuesday for talks to end the lockout of nearly 800 nurses and techs. L&M cut off health care and pay for the workers, and a defense fund for the nurses raised $20,000 in less than 24 hours.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Rebuilding America. The Rick Smith Show.
The walls come tumbling down. The walls come tumbling, tumbling. The walls come tumbling, tumbling down.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So as it appears, either sometime this week, happy Xmas, or maybe the first of the new year, we're going to see the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement coming up for a vote. And there are a number of people who said that they are not going to support it in the congressional delegation here from Pennsylvania. You've got Robert Brady, Chaka Fetah. You've got Mike Fitzpatrick, the Republican, saying he's not going to vote for it. Alison Schwartz, the gubernatorial candidate. Mike Doyle. Of course, Matt Cartwright, who we've had on the program a number of times, who are not going to do it, not going to allow fast track for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which I think is, again, you know, right now it doesn't surprise me that this is going to be something they throw out here while nobody's looking, because when you look at it, there's, like I said, Merry Xmas, because it's not merry, and it's certainly not holy. And it's just, well, I guess now would be the time, wouldn't it? while we're not looking, which is why I've asked our good friend Dave Johnson to come talk to us. He writes over at the Campaign for America's Future, the Our Future blog, ourfuture.org. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And by the way, it is Christmas if you're a billionaire.
Every day is Christmas if you're a billionaire.
Well, that's true.
The rewards and the spoils that we hand to our very well-to-do, 121% of all new income gains since the recovery. Hey, who wouldn't be happy with that?
That's right. Christmas forever if you're a billionaire. I got to correct one thing. You started out saying that the TPP comes up for a vote. It's fast track.
Fast track.
Yeah.
That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Thank you for the correction. So what exactly?
My wife says I correct her all the time. So
that's okay.
You're not alone.
If I say something wrong, I want to be corrected, and I yeah, that's what I meant. Well, we both suffer from that. So this fast track, explain what it means for folks who don't know. What is this? Because we've been hearing about it since the 80s. What is fast track?
Fast track is this game, this rigged process where they say, look, if every member of Congress gets to change a treaty, you know, and if every member of Congress can disapprove of it, you know, and we get to filibuster it, then we'll never get these things passed. Or, in other words, if you let democracy function, you won't have these kinds of trade treaties. But that's not how they word it. Fast track means that Congress can't make changes to a trade treaty that comes before it. And it means that it can't be filibustered in the Senate. It also means they have to vote on it in a hurry. So it's so far outside of what the Constitution says is supposed to happen, but Congress is expected then to voluntarily vote for these things. And these corporate arguments of, oh, well, if you have all this meddling by representatives and stuff, you could never get these things done. Yeah. If democracy takes a look at these treaties, it says, wait a minute, look what they're going to do to our country. Of course, you'll never get them done. And look what they've, I'm sorry, Rick, I come on your show and I shout. But look what they've done to the country. I mean, here in Pennsylvania, you know what it's done to the country, these trade treaties. So the fast track process, they get this fast track passed, and then what will happen is they'll start this drumbeat, this incredibly funded corporate campaign. You think the rush up to the Iraq war was a big sell. Just watch what happens for TPP. So fast track is Congress voting to give up its constitutional duty to closely look at these treaties. Let me add one more point. They're expected to vote on fast track when the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, that's the big elephant that we're talking about here, when they haven't even read it, it's still secret. So that's what fast track is, and that's what's coming up. Either this week or, because, you know, they're only working a couple of days in January.
Well, let me steal a line from Nancy Pelosi. You know, once you find out what's in it, you'll love it.
Yeah, once you find out what's in it, I'll tell you something. Some of it's leaked, and so we're getting the idea of what's in it. We have here another what they call trade treaty, and it's really, and the actual language is investor protections, meaning people who have a lot of money are protected.
Right.
Yeah. And the process of putting together this treaty has been that corporate representatives are participating, and they're allowed to read the treaty. Our own Congress is not. It's negotiated by governments, but the thing that happens these days now is that everybody involved in negotiating the treaty knows that after the treaty is negotiated, they can leave government and get a lucrative job with some corporation as long as they play along.
So like Billy Townsend, the guy who was a congressman from Louisiana, when he strong-armed and helped Bush pass the we're not going to negotiate for prescription drugs. We're going to pay retail because we're Americans, damn it.
Right.
We pay retail. And
right.
then quit.
We don't negotiate the price.
And
right.
then quit in the middle of his term to go take the CEO job at Big Pharma, the drug company lobbying arm.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
That's right. And he was getting millions, and now he's getting even more millions. Right, exactly. Within weeks, I think, of passing that law, he left to go work for Pharma. And that's what they see in front of them, potentially. I'm not saying all of them, but it's the obvious game that's played now, not just in our government, but around the world as this treaty gets negotiated. And the things that are leaking out And I got to say, why are we hearing about a major trade treaty from WikiLeaks, okay? It's secret. We're not allowed to know. The things that are leaking out show that when you have a process where only corporate interests are at the negotiating table, there aren't any consumer groups at the negotiating table. There aren't any trade unions at the negotiating table.
Do you know
table.
Why?
Why?
Well, as I've always said, if you're not sitting at the table, you're on the menu.
Yeah, exactly. You're the dinner.
That's it.
That's exactly what's coming out. So while we don't know everything that's in the treaty, we do know from what we've seen that what's leaked so far looks like it's just a corporate dream machine being whipped up. They're actually setting up that our government is not allowed to pass laws that interfere with the profits of corporations. And I'm going to give you one example of a controversy in this treaty. The treaty so far is worded such that it is illegal for countries to put together anti-smoking drives.
And what's wrong with that?
Because the tobacco companies will lose profits. Yeah. And the controversy is that some countries are saying, no, this is just going too far. You can't do that. Tobacco, after all, as if, you know, there's all kinds of other things companies do to profit off of the harm done to people. But tobacco's pretty well known. It still kills 440,000 Americans a year. All right, so the controversy, though, is that other corporations are saying, no, you can't carve out, is the words they're using, you can't carve out tobacco from this treaty because that sets a precedent of allowing governments to interfere with corporate profits if you let them interfere with tobacco profits by trying to protect the citizens. I mean, that is just stunning to most of us, but it makes perfect sense.
Here's the thing. You see, you're regulating, and regulating is bad. You know the EPA is a job-killing organization?
Exactly. And so the process of keeping out environmental groups, consumer groups, health groups, labor groups, the process necessarily leads to a treaty that's rigged for a few corporate interests, and that's what it looks like we're going to see. Now, I'm going to present for you the other side of the story for a minute. A trade treaty isn't by itself a bad thing by any means.
No,
okay?
I'm not against trade.
Imagine a trade treaty that says it's a violation, it's a trade violation to threaten workers who are asking for raises, to threaten to move their jobs across a border to a cheaper country. Imagine a trade treaty that says it's a violation to do that. A trade treaty could be written that way.
No, it couldn't.
It could.
No. I don't know what planet you're living on, but the corporate interests that run this country, the owners of this country, and the owners of the globe would never allow workers to have rights. Come on, we have this facade. We have this minor belief that working people have some rights in this country. Come on, we both know better than that.
Well, one of the justifications for this Trans-Pacific Partnership with all these Pacific Rim countries, and not China, and China is not being asked to join us, is to confront the economic power of China and what they're doing, okay? But it's not like China's doing anything that we're letting them do these things. We're not stopping them. We're using China to, as I said a minute ago, threaten people here and say either we're going to lower prices by moving jobs over there, or if you complain about your job, we'll move your job too, so we're going to cut your wages. I mean, that's the game that's being played with it, but the justification for the treaty is to do something about the power of China and how it's now taking on all these giant American companies too. So they've gotten out of hand, and they're looking for a way around it. The trouble is they're looking for a way around it for the 1%. Trade treaties could be written for the 99%, but it looks like this one is not. Fast track is the game. Fast track is the way they're going to be able to push this through. So the thing we've got to fight is fast track, and we've got to fight it because they're going to try to push this through so fast. They're making so many deals behind closed doors that we've got to get ahead of this and make sure that every representative and every senator knows we oppose fast track. We should make fast track as much of a test for our votes as we make Social Security, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, but I look at this, and you know, there are going to be those who oppose fast track just because we're giving something to the black guy in the White House. And then there are people like me who just purely oppose the idea of fast track. I opposed it when George H.W. Bush wanted it. I oppose it now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, as you pointed out at the very beginning, this is taking Congress's job, their rights away. And
right.
I can't imagine being anywhere in Congress saying, well, yeah, I want you to do my job.
It literally says, we don't want democracy meddling with this. That's literally the justification when they say, you think that every representative should be allowed to decide what should be in or not in a treaty. Well, that's what the Constitution says. And so that's why they have to pass fast track and set aside the constitutional duty of the Congress and the Senate to get these treaties through the way they're written. And that's also why they're pushing fast track before anybody's even allowed. And there's a weird word that our Congress is not allowed to read a treaty.
Yeah, I remember the guy from Florida, Alan Grayson, said that he was allowed to read it, but he couldn't talk about it. We were at Netrich Nation.
And he couldn't take notes.
And he couldn't, nothing. And I'm going, you're a congressman. What happens to a congressman if you come out and say, I read this? What could they do? Are they going to send you to Guantanamo Bay?
Right.
What happens to you if you come out and say this? It's got to be something really ugly that even we can't know about for someone like Grayson, who, you know, has been someone who likes poking people in the eye, especially the conservatives, every now and again. I can't imagine why what could hold him back?
Well, I understand that if you're going to have your secret clearance, et cetera, I think he could literally be prosecuted if he talked about it from things he signed, but I don't know, in order to see it.
See?
I don't know. Good point. Very good point. What's holding him back? That's a good thing I'd like to find out. But the idea that they would be voting on fast track, voting on a process to ram through a treaty that they haven't read. So, yes, on the one side, and I just read something today from a Tea Party person saying we need to oppose this because it lets the black guy in the White House ram through a treaty.
A treaty that most of them would have been in favor for had it been George W. Bush
exactly.
or George H.W.
Exactly.
Bush or sainted Ronald Reagan. They'd have been all on board.
But the magic word for the Tea Party is sovereignty. The treaty literally overrides American sovereignty, just like the United Nations. More than anything we've ever done with the United Nations does, it literally says this country is not allowed to make a law, and, for example, to limit smoking. So that's what's coming, and that's exactly how they plan to use it. It's literally at a time when democracy is rising up around the world. They're putting together this treaty that sets that democracy aside. Here's an important point. This is not what we like to call the corporations and business interests. It is some corporations and business interests, the
right.
ones that are already huge and dominant, and the billionaires behind them. If you're a small startup corporation that wants to compete with them, this is going to put you out of luck, okay? This locks in their dominance. This is the big corporations of the world chopping up the world for them, and it limits the competition that can come up and challenge them. So it's not corporate interest. This is the billionaires currently trying to continue to dominate and keep the dominance that they currently have.
Yeah, I mean, you hear all this deregulation talk, and I remember the Reagan years. It was, we need to deregulate, more deregulation. We got more regulations now than we've ever had. I called it the era of re-regulation, because just as you pointed out, you've got these handful of really big, powerful corporations with their huge lobbying arm and all of the campaign cash that we give them to hand out. And they've got this enormous power to rewrite laws that benefit them and harm everybody else.
Yep. That is the game we're seeing played out here with this Trans-Pacific Partnership. A WikiLeaks, I understand, and I think it was in Huffington Post this morning, another one came out. Remember that earlier the chapter on intellectual property and copyrights was leaked to WikiLeaks.
Right.
We have to read a treaty. Our government's negotiating through WikiLeaks. I mean, what? So, I mean, that says everything you need to know about the secrecy and transparency of this. And the earlier one showed things like that the giant drug companies are trying to clamp down on anybody being able to sell drugs cheaper than them, smaller companies competing with them. Well, WikiLeaks, I think it was WikiLeaks this morning, had some notes from another country, not the U.S., and you couldn't identify what country, and their reactions to the treaty, and they're talking about how this is all giant American corporations trying to force through their dominance. Now, why would another country sign up for that? Well, that's what's going on, is they're coming to them and beating them on the head with, we'll let you sell, and your particular large corporate interests who are dominating your country right now will get rich off of this treaty because we'll let you sell more to us than you do now. Now, that, listen to what that means.
That
really
means more trade deficits.
It means more jobs going to them. It says we'll buy from you instead of American companies, American workers, for a while, so you'll get a few billion in your pocket if you sign this. That's the trade-off that's going on right now. It's they'll give up a little more of the American workers' pay to them so that their rich people can make a few billion off of this if they can get their country to sign this. So that's the trade that's going on.
And you, the working people, in every country.
They're not part of this.
In every country, you're screwed.
Yeah, exactly. They're literally bribing a few people in each of these countries with contracts and stuff that you'll get for a while if you sign this treaty that guarantees American dominance, American large multinational company dominance, and some European companies and, you know, various other current dominating giant companies.
Nice. Nice.
Nice.
So glad for that.
Yeah,
and that's a nice thing to take me into the holidays. I appreciate that, Dave. Thanks so much.
Merry Christmas. Are you gonna fly somewhere on your jet for the holidays?
Yeah, I got it parked in my backyard. No one could get in it, but it flies around my backyard.
Ah, there you go.
Oh man. So how do we stop this?
Fast track. Yep. Fast track is the key to this. That's how they're gonna try to ram it through. They're gonna try to sneak through fast track in a hurry because it's not the treaty, but it really is. It's the thing that opens the gate to let them ram through the treaty. We got to fight fast track. We're close, too. There's enough members of Congress that get it, and then when you combine that with the Tea Party members that are concerned about sovereignty, and it's literally about who we can keep from getting paid off at this point, I think. If enough people get the word out that this is being snuck through right now, we can stop this. So literally call your member of Congress and both senators and say, you get it. You know what's going on. You want to make sure they don't vote for fast track and that's as important to you as anything they do on Social Security, too. These are the two main tests, is Social Security, I think, and fast track with TPP. So that's how you fight it. And we might be able to win this. They were able to keep fast track out before, and there's enough word out about this, I think. And you're doing this job, getting it out there. The more we get the word out, stop fast track, that stops this corporate takeover.
I'm hoping call your congressman, call your senator, call anybody who will listen, right?
Call your relatives and tell them to call. That's
absolutely
key.
Absolutely, because this, I don't care where you're at on the political spectrum, this is just bad for the country in my view. Dave, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the work you do over there at the Campaign for America's Future. I appreciate
Thanks.
The time. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks for having me on.
Quick break, right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Timmy Geithner has landed. The Secretary of the Treasury in President Obama's first term resigned early this year, and we lost track of him for months. But in November, Geithner reappeared, having spun himself through Washington's revolving door, whoosh, 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 and and flung himself all the way up to Wall Street, landing softly in the cushy quarters of Warburg Pincus, one of America's top 10 private equity empires. Yes, the guy who was responsible for rescuing and regulating Wall Street's too-big-to-fail multi-billion-dollar financial casinos is now president of one. Writing in the New Yorker magazine, Andrew Huszar says we need not be surprised that the former Treasury chief is cashing in on his insider knowledge and contacts. Huszar worked at the New York Federal Reserve Bank when Geithner became president of that powerful supervisor of Wall Street firms. He says that rather than promoting knowledgeable regulators from within the Fed, Geithner broke with tradition and prudence to put top bankers from J.P. Morgan Chase, American Express, Goldman Sachs, and other powerhouse firms in key regulatory positions. In other words, the new honcho built his own revolving door in the New York Fed, bringing in bankers to regulate themselves. Thus, when Obama promoted Geithner to head the Treasury Department, Huszar was again unsurprised that our nation's overseer of banksters quickly proved to be their comforter and protector. Geithner never publicly advocated for the truly forceful and clean revamp of Wall Street, writes Huszar, instead using his influence to convince Obama and other lawmakers to be more accommodating to the big banks. This is Jim Hightower saying, whether spinning from the inside out or from the outside in, Geithner is proof that the Washington Wall Street revolving door serves bankers, not the public interest. We need to weld it shut.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do?
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. You could also email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. Got an email during the break from Brian who says, I've been listening for years, and I have to be honest, I never thought you bashed corporations too much. I believe you're fair and tell it like it is. Appreciate your input. In fact, I think that you're one of the more pro-business people on the air. And I think I am. I think I am very much pro-business when it comes to playing by the rules, setting a tone for everyone, because I'm a competition guy. I believe, you know, like a lot of folks, I believe you compete not by rigging the rules, not by free trade agreements that pick winners over the rest, pick corporations over the workers of all the world. I think trade agreements can be good. I'm not anti-trade. I've said that a number of times. Just like I'm not anti-business. But when you have these behemoths, when you have these huge corporations that wield all of this influence, who set this tone that all regulations are bad. Regulations are bad. And, you know, we just have all these onerous, job-killing regulations. Or minimum wage is too high. Or, you know, unions don't create jobs. They hurt them. Which most of that, all of it's bunk. Understand, if you have a level playing field, and this is what government does. I don't want government creating all the jobs. I want them to be employer of last resort for those who can't. I go back to A. Philip Randolph, who back in the 60s was furious that they created welfare to be a handout system. He wanted jobs programs. Because I do believe that there is a therapeutic quality to work. I do believe that there is something that comes with making your own way, a bit of self-confidence, a bit of self-confidence, and a bit of pride that comes with all of that. But more than that, it comes that you can't, the right doesn't, you don't get bashed. You know, I look at welfare, I look at Medicaid, I look at food stamp programs, I look at a lot of the things that we hear the right complaining about. When Mitt Romney said 47% of the people pay no federal income tax, yeah, those are 47% of the low-wage workforce. And I think at some point we need to have an adult conversation about what kind of an economy we want to have. We need to have an adult conversation about, okay, do we want to pursue a low-wage nation economy, like the Walmarts, like the fast food restaurants. Is that what we want? When you have these huge corporations that we're subsidizing heavily, the fast food industry, we give $7 billion a year in subsidies to their employees. That's not even the money we give them. That's just subsidies to subsidize low wages. So we have to have that adult conversation. Are we okay with that? Is that what we want? Because if it is, look, I could be persuaded to the very conservative pro-business position of Milton Friedman, who came up with a negative tax idea. I could be convinced of that. As long as people are being, can find a way to make a living and put a roof over their head and food on their tables and clothes on their backs and be productive citizens, I'm okay with Friedman's idea of giving a whole boatloads of money to these folks to work in crummy low-wage jobs. I'm not against it. But then don't turn and have an entire political party in this country and some of another pointing their fingers going, lazy, lazy, lazy. They're the problem. They're the reason. No, you've set up this model that encourages people to have to produce low-wage jobs. We've got a pathetically low minimum wage. And I look at this and I go, you know, you've got these huge companies, huge, powerful companies paying, you know, wages that aren't sustainable. Look, so we got to have that conversation. Or we go, you know what, we need to organize. We need to give workers rights to bargain and bargain for the profits that they create. So we do like they did in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. On the job sites, they look at each individual company, what the profit margins are, what the CEO makes, all of this stuff, and they say, we'd like a slice of the wealth that we create. And that starts with each and every working person. That starts with every person in this country. But I am very pro-business. I think they should all be on the same level. And you know, you look at all of this money that we've given away over the years. You know, it's nice to talk about, well, you know, location and education and infrastructure. Those are all great things. And every site location person I've ever met, all of the consultants and all the corporate people who I've met over the years who do this stuff for a living say, you know, we look for location, 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 and then infrastructure and an educated workforce. Pennsylvania has location, location, location. We're within a day's drive of 60-70% of the population. Our infrastructure is the worst in the country. Ask any truck driver. But we still can get from place to place, sort of. Educationally, one of the best in the country. We've got an amazing publicly owned university system. We've got amazing universities and colleges in this state. Our K-12 education is suffering quite a bit. But that can be turned around, hopefully, in 2014. So why aren't we creating jobs hand over fist? I know it's easy to say, oh, it's our tax rate. No, it's not. We've got one of the highest tax rates in the country, Rick. Don't you know? Yeah, I do know. And much like the 35% federal tax rate that the big companies don't pay, understand, mom and pop pays the high tax rates. Mom and pop pays those the highest rates. The multi-state, multinational companies, are you kidding me? They've crafted enough loopholes that we've got the Delaware loophole. The magic box in Delaware. You know, just a little, you know, 4x4 box, about a foot deep, with a PO number on it. That's where all the profits go. We won't close that. Why? Corporations don't want it. They want their profits. So this idea that, oh, you're not business friendly, you're right. Not in the frame that's been shoved down my throat, which is we need to hand big money and big checks to these companies. You want good infrastructure, you want an educated workforce, I'm right there with you. I'll fight to the death with you. But if I'm going to give away my kids' future to give tax money away, are you kidding me? It's nuts. Before I take a break, a smart bipartisan piece of legislation. State Representative Neil Goodman has introduced legislation to establish a Made in Pennsylvania program. Goodman is a Democrat from Schuylkill County. He has paired up with Eli Ivanovich, the Republican from Westmoreland, Armstrong County. They are co-chairs of the House Manufacturing Caucus. They say it's going to, you know, encourage people to buy locally. And the sad thing is, you know, I think we should just be doing it as a matter of course. They say that the bill will not only encourage the use of Pennsylvania-made products through heightened awareness, it will also provide suppliers a database for companies so they can more easily source their product needs from Pennsylvania manufacturers, which I'm in favor of. What I would like to see is procurement on the state level being first and foremost. Companies right here. It blows my mind and frustrates and angers me that all of the Penn State apparel, all of the hats and T-shirts and mugs and all of that stuff, not made in Pennsylvania. In fact, most of it not even made in the United States. Blows my mind. But I guess this is a start to get people aware. So we'll probably talk to somebody here later in the week on this because I think it's that important. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back.
It's 97 crosses, hanging in the cold ass yard. 97 families, who lost 97 farms. I think about my grandpa, my neighbors and my name. It's a nice to be like that.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Detroit's bankruptcy is in federal court as the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees fights to prevent the bankruptcy from slashing modest city retiree pensions. AFSCME Associate General Counsel Michael Arts says the union has three main arguments to defend the average $19,000 annual pensions of city workers. AFSCME says the bankruptcy is invalid because it violates Michigan's Constitution, that it violates the federal Constitution by intruding on state and city rights to manage their own affairs, and that legally required good faith bargaining with creditors did not happen before the bankruptcy was filed. Arts says this would be the ideal outcome in AFSCME's challenge to Detroit's bankruptcy.
That the retirees' pensions be protected, and that going forward we work out an arrangement where there can be some sort of defined benefit plan going forward so workers can have retirement security, but we can find out a way to make sure that Detroit is a vital city going forward.
Arts says that the bankruptcy plan puts bankers ahead of workers, as Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's appointed Detroit City Manager Kevin Orr pushes to reorganize Detroit's finances. When GM and Chrysler filed for bankruptcy, it was managed by the Obama administration to save pensions. Arts says Governor Snyder could also put the modest pensions off limits in this bankruptcy, especially since the Michigan State Constitution bans diminishing public worker pensions.
This is a moral choice that Detroit has made and that Governor Snyder has made to honor banks and corporations over regular people and over retirees, and we don't think that's right. We're hopeful that the appellate courts recognize that because you have to have state authorization in order for cities to file for bankruptcy, that the courts recognize that state laws should matter, and especially state constitutions should matter, and when the people decide through their elected representatives that pensions should be protected, and that if there's going to be financial problems, that the banks should have to give back first, that the corporations should have to give back their tax breaks first before we start putting our elderly and our retirees out on the street.
AFGE and NTEU, the two largest federal worker unions, are calling on Congress not to once again target federal workers as budget negotiators try to reach a deal. Budget negotiators are attempting to force federal workers to contribute more to pensions with no increase in the annuities payout when the workers retire. The unions note that federal workers have already given up $114 billion toward federal deficit reduction. Locked out AFT nurses at L&M Hospital in Connecticut could meet with management Tuesday for talks to end the lockout of nearly 800 nurses and techs. L&M cut off health care and pay for the workers, and a defense fund for the nurses raised $20,000 in less than 20
24 hours.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. Today in history, China declared war against Japan, Germany, and Italy, the axis of evil, back in 1941. Also on this date, the John Birch Society was formed and declared war on rational thought. Charlie Brown Christmas premiered back in 1965, and Lech Wallach was elected president in 1990. That was today in history. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, what's on your mind?
Hey, well, I did not know that today was such a historic date.
Yep.
The first airing of the Charlie Brown Christmas special. That's pretty great.
A really important moment in the history of this nation, and something that every child since 1965 has been forced to view.
Oh, I liked it.
You know, I my wife was telling me, because we were talking about bullying, and I'm one, and I know I'm going to take flack again for this, but I'm one who thinks that this anti-bullying thing has just gotten way too far out of hand. That we spend too much time talking about it, and we're going to have a generation full of "he touched me" when they're in their 40s. But my wife was telling me a story of a friend who evidently the kid and the father were out kicking the football around, and the father goes, "And I won't do what Lucy did." And the kid's like, "You know, well, what did Lucy do?" And the old man explained to him, Lucy used to pull the football away. The kid ran into the house crying, saying, "Daddy's bullying me!" It's gotten out of hand, Justin. Just gotten out of hand. Anyway, I understand the president's en route to South Africa.
Yes, he is. He's going to be appearing there tomorrow to deliver the opening remarks at Nelson Mandela's memorial service. He is expected to speak for about 10 to 15 minutes discussing Nelson Mandela's impact on South Africa as well as on his life personally. We're also getting news that it's going to be sort of an awkward stage for the president. We know that there is, in fact, going to be the Brazilian president who recently has pulled out of U.S. functions regarding the NSA surveillance programs, as well as Raul Castro, who's going to be on the stage with him. So, look forward to some right-wing furor over that. But nevertheless, he is scheduled to be speaking tomorrow.
Clinton jumped into the middle of that whole thing. And look, I don't know that we should be spying on anyone. But when Clinton jumped in and said, "Oh, but we shouldn't be spying on your dealings," I just kind of thought, can't you go away for a little while?
I know, and it certainly does make sense. You know, we've seen him, being more than eager to weigh in on politics and a lot of these things, as well as, the growing emergence of Hillary Clinton's kind of political life. So not very surprising, but certainly a sign of what's to come.
But I look at the president going to South Africa, and maybe, that's, for now, it's a good place to go, with all of the nonsense. Did you see this, the chairman of the Virginia Republican Party, who said that Obama's so close to death that Terry McAuliffe's about to buy life insurance on him?
That's pretty terrible. I don't think I've heard that one.
Yeah, you go, where do these guys come up with this stuff? And, I guess, is it okay to say now? I guess it is. It is exactly what it is. I understand we also sold the rest of our interest in General Motors.
Yes, we have. The U.S. has officially signed off on the last of the shares that we bought in the big motor giant following the early 2009 crisis. Capping out what we've done for the two previous ones, this is the final one. And it looks like the U.S. is actually about $10.5 million down from what it initially invested. But nevertheless, we saw a statement coming out from the president defending the move, saying, of course, that this was something that had to be done in order to secure the heart of American manufacturing, and that the benefit it got for saving American jobs as well as keeping these industries afloat was well worth the loss that we received.
And could you make the argument that it's, that you know actually we'll make that loss back by having those jobs around still? I mean, look, if we've got all these billions to hand out to General Electric to move jobs to China or to Lucent Technologies or any of these other really big, huge corporations who have virtually no tax payment to our government, don't we have something that would say, you know, we're gonna help working people? I mean, because to me, I view this very differently than I think most people.
Well, no, I mean, it's certainly true. It certainly does make sense down the road. In a way, this is sort of if not stimulus plan, this was a way to keep the U.S. from going into, certain disaster, at least when it comes to American manufacturing. And it certainly looks like it was an investment that paid off.
What's going to be interesting to me in the next 6 months to a year is what happens with the CEO pay and with the executive pay. Because as part of our helping them, there was a cap on executive compensation. And now you got to wonder, does that change?
That's a very good point. And I'm guessing that now that it's pulled out, the U.S. isn't going to be able to invoke that as easily. But that certainly is going to be something that's going to be worth watching as time goes on.
Yeah, I'm really very interested in seeing that. Because, then the turnaround will come and, skyrocketing CEO paying the new, maybe you're right back where you started from. The NSA story has been big today. I guess they were paying people to play video games?
That's what it looks like. There was apparently some fear that was expressed by the NSA, the CIA, as well as some British intelligence agencies, that essentially terrorists could be using World of Warcraft in order to try to get subversive messages out to their followers and stuff without proper detection, as well as a number of other online platforms. So this was revealed today by ProPublica through documents provided by Edward Snowden. And, really at the end of the day, it kind of looks like someone's probably caught playing video games and then trying to look for an excuse. But nevertheless, there we have it. Not even our online mythical worlds are safe from the NSA.
But here's the thing. And, I remember, someone said, did you hear this? Oh, it's an abomination. I'm going, well, they've been doing that for years. I mean, isn't this old news? Because I had heard back, in 2002, 2003, that Al-Qaeda was in the video game world because there was this, this online community and they were playing these video games. And, I thought we'd been doing this for years.
Well, a lot of the surveillance things with that Edward Snowden did release were things that people were fairly confident was going on. But, of course, now we have documentation and a paper trail to justify a lot of those kind of nagging paranoid thoughts.
So I guess the other question is, do we care?
That certainly is a good question. I think this raises some serious questions over whether or not the intelligence industry is using their best resources, since it doesn't really seem like this is really a hotbed for crime, and whether or not this was probably the best use of funds remains to be seen. And we haven't really seen anybody come out and justify these movements into this sort of area. So it just really shows how deep they've really gotten with all of this and whether or not it's actually worth the money that was invested.
Because I look at this and I guess it's always easy to go, well, I don't do it, so yeah, go ahead. And I look at it and go, I really don't care, but I guess once you start doing it at one level, then it goes to another level, and then it just snowballs.
That's certainly what it looks like. And, this is something that has raised a lot of eyebrows, especially because this is something that's been such a widely used kind of a, commercial product, and it doesn't necessarily make sense for them to be doing this without the consultation of, the company behind it, in this case Blizzard, who says that they were not aware of these surveillance practices, nor would they necessarily have signed off on them.
Hmm. Anything going on Capitol Hill today?
Capitol Hill is pretty quiet. There's, of course, going to be a last-minute scramble to try to pass some legislation, including the fund bill and whatnot, but right now nothing is necessarily firmly on the docket. We did see some more push for immigration reform from activists today, but for the most part, things were pretty quiet.
So should we be passing an unemployment extension, an unemployment insurance extension? Because, I don't know if you saw Rand Paul over the weekend saying it would be doing a disservice to those people.
I don't believe I saw those remarks, but that certainly is sort of the right-wing rhetoric that we've been hearing so far. And also, to inform your listeners about this, some late breaking news at the end of the day. In Texas, it turns out that Representative Steve Stockman, who is one of the crazier members of Congress. This sort of makes Ted Cruz look like a moderate, has announced that he is going to be running in the Republican primary in the state against Senator John Cornyn. So that's sort of a precursor to some fireworks that are likely going to be coming up in the coming months. And, you know, that's always something that's fun, considering this is a guy who, invited Ted Nugent to the State of the Union address, who threatened to impeach Obama, and is someone who is, not the most calm when it comes to right-wing rhetoric.
Interesting. So the state of Texas is even going further off the deep end. Yeah, someone sent me an email a little earlier that evidently there's a, because they wanted me to buy this coloring book. I guess they've got a Senator Ted Cruz coloring book. The people at Really Big Coloring Books has put out this thing. Having kids color in the Ted Commandments and having kids color in the Obamacare speech that he did for 21 hours, where he says millions of citizens believe Obamacare was worse than any war. And you go, is your propaganda to children any more obvious than a Ted Cruz coloring book?
Well, I hope you're able to color in Green Eggs and Ham. That's my little request.
This is the same group that on the 10th anniversary of 9/11 put out a We Shall Never Forget 9/11 Kids Book of Freedom coloring book.
Well, there we go. Trying to reach out when they're young.
Yeah, I guess. Just insanity. Anyway, Justin, it's always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.theRickSmithShow.com.
We're smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I've got a golden chance to make my way. And with a golden ticket, it's a golden day.
Well, it's time to talk about the Pennsylvania Society, and I guess the Pennsylvania Society is going to have their big gala there in New York City here. I guess the end of this week, December 12th, 13th, 14th. So this is the big weekend. This is the weekend where the who's who of the political world, the big moneyed special interests, this is where it all comes together. This is where the big donors, where the corporate guys, they get direct access to all of the people holding the levers of power on both parties. Look, you know, this is what it is. This is the feeding trough for our politicians to go. And there are a number of, you know, big cocktail parties, the holiday cocktails by Christine J. Toretta. According to Politics PA, there's no better room in the world to network with Pennsylvania Republicans than RNC Committeewoman Toretta's annual bash. Good luck getting in if you're not on the list, they write, because it is a invitation-only event. The Pennsylvania House leadership, Republican leadership, is having a reception. Penn Strategies is going to have their reception, you know, hosted by Penn Strategies and Penn Law Group. So the lawyers are going to get theirs. The PA GOP annual Commonwealth Luncheon is going to be there. Mayor Giuliani, former Republican mayor of New York, Giuliani is going to be there for a photo op. And for only $2,500, you can get lunch and your picture with Rudy. Only $2,500, and you can get a table for $10,000 if you want. And you just go down the list, and it's basically the who's who is running the state. You know, all of these UPMCs, worldwide corporation, EDMC, EverPower, let's not forget Consol Energy's got their shindig. Waste Management of Pennsylvania is going to have a cocktail party. You know, just down the list, all of the moneyed folks, NI Source Gas is going to have a cocktail and dinner reception. Yeah, I mean, they're all there. Mike Terzay is going to have a reception to honor himself. So that's nice at the Waldorf Astoria. And you just go down the list, the Captains of Industry reception hosted by Consol Energy. Oh, but Rick, you're just beating them up. PNC Bank's going to have a breakfast reception, invitation only. You better have some clout to get into that. PMA and Wells Fargo going to have a seminar and luncheon. And, of course, one of the folks there is going to be the head of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, Fred Anton. And down the list, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, the whole nine yards. They're going to have their little thing. The Bravo Group, they're going to have their little invitation-only reception. And, you know, right down the list, you go down all of this. It's the who's who of who contributes to campaigns and who pays it off. And it's going to be, you know, finished off by the Marcellus Shale Coalition reception. Going to have dancing, and you're going to get some, you know, the free bar, get you all liquored up from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. On Saturday night. Going to get you all liquored up. It's as what Politics PA says, this is one of the biggest events of the weekend. And the place to meet Pennsylvania's energy industry leaders. Yeah, but Rick, you're just beating up the Marcellus Shale people. They won't come here if you don't treat them nicely. They just won't come. They'll go somewhere else. But the gas is here. Yeah, but they'll forego all that money because you're not nice. Anyway, the big receptions, most of the vast majority of which you need an invitation to get into. You and I just can't walk into. And if we could, it would be a whole boatload of cash. Because that's what this is all about. And this is what our politics has turned into. It's no longer you and me and us getting together and voting for a candidate of our peers. It's basically, this is who the moneyed interests who have decided. This is who the corporatists have put in front of you. Pick which one is, who's less bad. And throughout my life, the presidential races have always been who's less bad. But they all pander to corporate special interests because that's what we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to do. Because they give us jobs. If we didn't do these things, they wouldn't come. Amazing stuff. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's color and light, the tide and flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.